Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, Spider-Man Far From Home has ended the summer slump in more ways than one, including it's just a really good movie. I loved it. Did you like it, Sean?
Yeah, it's really fun. I like Spider-Man. This is a good Spider-Man movie. It's a good Spider-Man movie and a good Mysterio movie, and I didn't know how much I needed some good like big budget Mysterio stuff in my life until I saw this movie.
There is so much more time spent with the bubblehead mask than I thought we would get, and I'm so happy.
Superhero movies have come a long way.
They really have. So we're going to talk about that later. I saw it last Tuesday when it came out, and I have been so excited to talk about it because it's also one of the more surprising superhero movies in a lot of ways. Even if you see some of the twists coming, there's others you won't. So really, really fun. We will talk about that at the end of the show, obviously. We've got some other pieces of stuff. You've been playing Judgment / Judge Eyes, the new game from the Yakuza people, right?
Yes, and that game is fucking awesome. It's so good. I've been playing the shit out of it. I think my play clock is like 28 hours, and I'm on chapter 5 of probably like 15 or so. So
holy crap.
Yes, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm playing that game the way I played all the Yakuza games, which is I am doing absolutely everything I possibly can as soon as I can do it.
Nice. So I'm excited to hear about that. We've got some other pieces of stuff to talk about. But first, I want to start with a bit of housekeeping. We've got Weekly Suit Gundam Episode 3 is out now on YouTube and in the normal podcast feed, so you can find it wherever you look for podcasts. And if you haven't been following, that is our bi-weekly series where we are talking about Mobile Suit Gundam, the original 1979 show. Kind of a passion project for you, Sean, but I gotta say, I think it's one of my favorite things we've ever done on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So that episode, if you want to hear us spend like 30 minutes talking about Ramba Rawl, that's the episode for you. And Gundam is awesome. It's really fun talking about it. People should listen to that podcast. I'm very excited to keep on going through that podcast and get to the end of Gundam because there's some shit ahead of us.
Oh, yeah. I've watched about 5 episodes beyond where we stopped. And, oh my God, that show just never stops being amazing. So we will talk more about that. Second, Sean, I have been doing... I spent the last week... kind of during my off... It's summer. You know, I don't have a ton going on. So I finally decided to do a project for the podcast that I have been wanting to do for a while now. We do a little piece of theme music every week, right?
Yes.
And it's one of my favorite things about doing the podcast is picking a piece of music to represent that week's topic or just a fun piece of music because sometimes we just do that. And it is really fun to pick the music and lay it in there and I have a lot of fun with it. But sometimes I look at a piece of music and I stop and I'm like... I don't know if we've used this, because I don't like reusing music. And we now have almost 300 episodes, and it's increasingly difficult to check if I've used music before. So I finally made an Excel spreadsheet that archives every piece of music we've ever used.
Okay, this is an interesting thing you decide to spend your time on. I mean, I understand it, but yeah, okay,
yeah.
Sure.
So I made what I wanted was a searchable document where I have the song title, the artist name, and the album name. And I have them all there so I can search and arrange and find everything easily. And I went through all 290 episodes of the podcast. I either used my... So I had, obviously, my ears, because many songs I just know by hearing.
Yeah, I mean, some, you picked the songs in the first place, so you should know them.
I should. A lot of them are Persona songs, of which there are roughly 1,000 tracks on my computer. So I had iTunes open and was cross-checking there. And then I also had my phone open and was using the Shazam app, which is the app that's made for, like, if you're in a bar and you hear a song, you pull out the Shazam app and it tells you what the song is.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked for more music than I thought it would. And at the end, I had about 6 tracks I didn't know and couldn't identify. Thomas, my brother, was able to find 3 of them because they were just pieces of Persona music where I'm like, I found most of it, but Thomas, you are the Persona music guy, so you find these last 3. And then I think there are only 2 more from the very early days that I cannot find the source for. But I have a complete searchable Excel spreadsheet with all of our music we've ever used. So if you're curious, I can make that public if anyone wants it. But, Sean, I thought it would be fun to share some of the stats with you now that I have it.
Okay, good, yes, because that's what I wanted to hear. I need to know what's like the hot data that you've collected on this podcast.
Yes. All right, so first off, Sean, and we'll make it into a game. I have questions here, and you can make a guess. What is the longest streak we've had in terms of weeks in a row where we went from just one single album source? And what do you think that album was?
I mean, there's got to be like 5 or 6 weeks of just Persona 5 OST, right? Like, that's got to be... I'm going to say that's my guess. I'm going to say 5 weeks Persona 5 original soundtrack.
That's correct. It's 7 weeks in a row for the Persona... Yeah, we went episodes 182 to 188 is all Persona 5 music. There was a brief break at 189, and then it came back for several weeks because this was also the same period when Twin Peaks was airing. So once in a while, it was mostly Persona 5 that spring. Once in a while, we would do a Twin Peaks music. And then Doctor Who premiered. That was like the busiest time for the podcast ever, if you remember that.
Yes, yeah, we were juggling three ongoing things at the same time, and it was ridiculous. Yes.
But there's a close runner-up. Can you guess what that is?
So seven songs. So it's something that's close to seven. So like something that's like probably 4 to 6 times in a row. I can't think of it. I mean, it's probably another Persona streak, but I don't know.
It's not. It's Spider-Man Rock Reflections of a Superhero. Because you'll remember.
Six
6 weeks in a row, episodes 252 to 257, because we did all of our Spider-Man 1, 2, 3, the Raimi things. Then the game came out, and we talked about that for a couple weeks. So we just went solid 6 weeks on Spider-Man Rock Reflections.
Yeah, I had forgotten that the Spider-Man movie thing lined up directly with the game. And so, yes, so we would have had multiple weeks in a row of just Spider-Man music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this next question is fairly related, but what single album do you think has been used the most times across 291 episodes of the podcast?
I'm going to say the Persona 4 original soundtrack. It's got to be one of the Persona soundtracks, but I'm not sure.
It is Persona, but it's Persona 5. Persona 5 had those initial 7, and then we have done it overall 15 times.
That makes sense, yeah. Obviously, it was one of the Persona tracks. Yeah,
it was. Persona 4, if you add up the original game, Golden, Reincarnation, Animation, and the spin-offs, it's Persona 4 by far. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking one album, Persona 4 Dancing comes in at number 2 at 10 times.
Okay, yes. That makes
sense.
Then,
including this week, Spider-Man Rock Reflections comes in 3rd at 8.
That's good, you know. That's where it should be. That feels right. Yep.
So obviously the composer most represented is Shoji Meguro. That's not even a contest. Who is number 2? Which composer or artist do you think we have used the second most behind Mr. Shoji Meguro?
I'm going to say it's probably a movie guy. So it's probably either like Hans Zimmer or John Williams. I'm going to say one of those two.
John Williams is at number 3 with 15 times he has shown up across different franchises. Number 2 is Murray Gold, the Doctor Who composer.
Oh, that makes sense.
We have used Murray Gold tracks 21 times. More for Doctor Who, because sometimes we dip into classic Who, but Murray Gold has 21 appearances on our show. Now, franchises, I don't have questions for... Well, you know what? I will. Obviously, the most used franchise is Persona. Do you want to ballpark a number guess of how many times we have used Persona music in 291 episodes?
I'm going to say it's got to be something like... I'm going to say 64.
You're lowballing it.
Okay. 75.
It's 81.
81. Jesus Christ.
We have used Persona 81 times. Doctor Who only 23 times. Now, I'm not counting the spin-off series we did with all the classic Who.
Yeah.
That's obviously every opening was Doctor Who. And then Star Wars for franchises comes in 3rd at 15.
That makes sense.
Now, you'll notice the John Williams number is 15. Not all of that is John Williams, because we have used some non-John Williams Star Wars music, including the I'm Han Solo song from Star Wars Connect, which John Williams had nothing to do with. But yes, that is the data I have collected for now. I'm sure there's others I could find, but I am very happy to finally have this spreadsheet. The final kick in the pants for me to do this was I knew I wanted to use more Spider-Man Rock Reflections of a Superhero this week, and I had no idea what we had and hadn't used. And we have, I believe, 2 songs left from that soundtrack that we have not used yet.
then we just start putting in the weird, like, Stan Lee interludes. Just have 15 minutes of Stan Lee narration at the top of each podcast.
We have used one of those when he died. We did use his final narration.
Yeah.
So we have used a lot of that CD. We're using all parts of that particular Buffalo.
I think the fact that you haven't mentioned it gives me the answer, but I just want to ask anyways. Have we really never reused a song? We've never
done.
Oh, no,
we have reused songs.
Okay, we have?
Yes, I got to look this up. The worst one ever was, I think, I used... Usually, they're, like, contextual. Like, I've reused everybody at New Year's 3 years for New Year's Day, and I don't mind that because it's, like, a fun tradition.
Sure, yeah.
That's from Persona 4 Golden. Some other ones that I just obviously forgot is there are two different X-Men movie weeks where I use the X-Men animated theme song and didn't bother checking. But that's also a really kick-ass song, so I don't think anyone minds. The worst one, I think, is, I gotta look this up, but it's Deep Breath, Deep Breath from Persona 3, but the reincarnation version.
Yeah.
I used that on episode 91, completely forgot, used it again on episode 95.
Okay, yeah, so that's because if you had said I used it on episode 91 and then I used it again on episode 223, it's like, fair right. enough.
Yeah, I think those are the three I remember I've reused, because I obviously have the data on that now, but yeah. Now I can guard against it. It's honestly, Sean, I'm surprised it hasn't happened more, because I didn't have this document. Now I do, now it probably will never happen again, but like, it's kind of surprising to me that there's only maybe 4 or 5 songs I've ever done it with.
Good job, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Good work.
Absolutely. So, that's fun. I had fun making my spreadsheet, and there you go.
That will come in handy forever.
It truly will. All right. Let's do some stuff. And before we dive into all the other stuff you and I have, Sean, because I've been playing some games, you've been playing Judgment, Thomas, my brother, who is currently in Japan, couldn't be on the show. He mailed in to me, emailed, he didn't physically okay. mail it. He emailed me a written review of Persona Q2, New okay. Cinema Labyrinth, on the Nintendo 3DS, because he has played the whole game. I have not played it, you have not played it. Would you like to hear Thomas's review of Persona Q2?
Yes, let's hear Thomas's review of the last 3DS game that people will care about.
So pretty much. And this is called Persona Q2, a bullet-pointed review. I have not read this yet, so this is new for both of us. It's really good, but the weakest Persona spinoff I've played, including both fighting games, the dancing games, and of course Persona Q1. My play clock was around 72 hours, and I did everything. All the special screenings and every optional boss, grinded to the top level, made a bunch of really good Personas, completed the compendium. There are 36 major characters in the game. 4 protagonists, 21 party members, 3 navigation characters, 6 velvet room attendants, and 2 new characters, plus a number of minor characters in each dungeon. The new major character, Hikari, winds up being really good, but not nearly as interesting as the girl in Q1. The same is true of the story overall. The ending is touching and grounded in interesting and inspiring ways, but less so than other Personas. The gameplay is pretty much the same as in Q1. There are a few new things, but it's mostly the same, plenty of fun. The dungeons are fun, but less challenging than in Q1. Each dungeon is a different movie in this game, and every dungeon has interesting mechanics that make them feel more unique, but each movie also has a pretty long original story, and by the third dungeon, the original stories get really old. This is my first major problem with the game, because each dungeon has its own story told while you're progressing through it. You get, this is in all caps, way less character interaction than in Persona Q1. Instead, you basically just get all the characters reacting to the movies. There's a good amount of character interaction in the dungeons, but the overall balance feels very off. Considering this was sort of the main selling point of the Q franchise, this was disappointing. The setting is a movie theater, which is fun, but it doesn't really have any space for character events, so they changed that system. They combined 2 elements from the first game into one. Elizabeth's requests and the character events, which everyone just talked at the school, labeled Stroll in the menu. The new mechanic is called Special Screenings, and at first blush, it's a really interesting and fun way for the characters to interact with each other. Each special screening has an objective and a cast of a few characters who are the focus. You get a bonus for using the characters in your party, so it's an interesting way to incentivize playing as a variety of characters. Again, it's cool because you get to have the characters discover common interests or develop friendships while exploring small segments of dungeons. But in the long run, this winds up being the game's biggest narrative weakness. In Persona Q1, there were a lot of strolls where the characters just talked at the school, and those were probably my favorite part of the game. They took time away from dungeon crawling, but they were short and sweet, and it felt like there were a lot of them. Enough for nearly every character to feel as though they had enough attention. And the focus was solely on the characters. In Q2, they add more gameplay, but the focus shifts away from the characters and onto these little objectives. Only at the end of events do characters have that, wow, look at how much we have in common conversation. And it is rarely as in-depth as the events in Q1. And even though it adds extra gameplay, they're so time-consuming that they feel more distracting than the events in the first game. There are 45 screenings in Q2, which sounds like a lot, but each event is limited to 3 characters at most, and around 7 are only one character, so with a cast of 28 potential party members, you can imagine the issue with this. Every character gets featured at some point, but many of them are short events sandwiched between a lot of dungeon crawling. That isn't to say they aren't good, although some of them aren't. Most of them are fun and interesting. For example, there's this ongoing thread that the Persona 3 portable protagonist feels like she doesn't belong because when the Persona 3 cast finally enters around halfway through the game, they're from the male protagonist universe. That's sad.
Yeah, that's a weird... That's a... Because I knew that the female protagonist from Persona 3 Portable was in the game, but I had no idea how that worked, and the idea that they actually, like, sort of made that canonical is weird and upsetting, yeah.
So she knows all of them, but none of them know her. This leads to a number of interactions between her and her C's friends, and I really wish there had been more of that instead of more dungeon crawling. I want a whole game about that, because, like, in the Persona 3 Portable, you can, like, romance Junpei, and in this one, he wouldn't know who you are.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, the, like, weird, like, existential crisis, Persona Q2, Persona 3 Portable, Protagonist Edition. I want that. Yeah.
Here's another example. Akechi has very little to do in the game, but there's one scene where he just barely hints that meeting all these other people has changed him somehow, and it's hinted at the end of the game that if he wasn't going to forget everything that happened, his fate might be different. I would have loved if that plot point had been seeded in a bunch of smaller events than in one slightly longer special screening. As in the first game, only characters in your party level up together. There are parts where you can get away with having one or two underleveled characters in your party, but by the last two dungeons, it's impractical. This is a shame, as there's a lot of fun dialogue and banter between the different casts during battle, but I never heard the majority of it because I had to stick to my core characters. I feel like this is an RPG faux pas by now in the year 2019.
Yeah, the fact that Persona 5 made the leap, like, once Persona 5 made the leap, everybody has to. Like, unless there's, like, a really specific reason why your game can't do it, which I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I can imagine that there is some sort of system or mechanic by which that would be a necessity. But unless you have some really weird specific thing for your game, everybody in your party should just fucking level up and share experience. Like, that's just how it should work.
Once Pokemon has made the leap, like, everybody has to, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so he says there's an item that raises a character's level to be equal to whatever your party's highest level is, but it's very rare, so you can't really use it anywhere except the end of the game. He says he has 7 total by the end of the game, and I think you can pay real money to get more. But again, in a game where character interaction is the main selling point, this seems ridiculous considering the cast size. The above few points together made me feel that after 72 hours, there wasn't nearly as much interesting character interaction as there should have been. While there were a lot of memorable scenes that I didn't mention, none of them ever really come up again, so it never feels important. Almost every character felt underutilized. But the music in the game is incredible. Mm-hmm. Every protagonist has a battle theme, and the new opening is good. The only theme I didn't love was the new boss theme, Nothing is Promised. It's kind of dull, especially compared to Q1's Laser Beam. But how can you surpass Laser Beam? That's
Laser
a fucking Beam's great song.
A classic.
Add to this the additional 9 battle themes you get as free DLC, and you have probably the best playlist of battle music in any game. He was telling me about this. You get all the battle music from, like, the Persona franchise you can just use. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and he says, despite his criticism, I really enjoyed the game. Think it's worth playing if you have affection for the different Persona casts. Some of these problems were inevitable given the cast size. Ultimately, my biggest issue is that the game focuses too much on its own stories and not enough on how these characters' friendships would develop. Still, it's fun, and I'm glad I picked it up. And apparently poured 72 hours into it. Good
well,
for
there
him.
You go. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is Thomas's review of Persona Q2. And there we go. I kind of still want to play it, but I don't know when I will.
Yeah, like it makes sense to me of that, you know, them adding a whole other game's worth of characters onto it without making any cuts anywhere. It seems inevitable, kind of like what you said in the review, that they would run into some of those problems of large sections of characters feeling underserved and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Sean, do you want to tell us about a game you are loving?
Oh, yes, Jonathan. Judgment, Judge Eyes, whatever you want to call it. I kind of like calling it Judge, even though I think it's dumb that they changed the title. I find the title Judgment very funny because when you say it to people and they're not in the right mind frame, or when you get a text message that has that word in it and you're not, like, in the right mind frame, it's a very shocking word for someone to just, like, it's like, oh yeah, I've been playing Judgment. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? But yeah, so Judgment is the new game from Ryuga Gotoku Studios, or the Yakuza Studio, as we kind of call it over here, because that's what that the game series got localized as, is Yakuza. So it's a... it's not technically a Yakuza game in the sense that it does not have Kiryu in it. It doesn't have, as far as I know, any returning characters. There maybe is a cameo later. I have not seen anybody I know from the other Yakuza games. But it is set in the same world. So it's set in Kamurocho. It uses the same map. If you played Yakuza Kiwami 2, or I assume Yakuza 6 is the same, because it's on the same engine as those games. It is the same basic sort of city layout and all that kind of stuff, which is what they do for these games. So you're exploring Kamurocho, which is this kind of fictional, skeevy part of Tokyo. And so it has that same sense of world building. It has the same kind of balance of humor and drama as the Yakuza games. And it has sort of the same gameplay foundation. So the pacing of the game, the storytelling style, the way that story, you have the main story, and then you have side cases or sub-stories under it, and then you have a bunch of mini-games and friendships, all that kind of structural stuff is shared from the Yakuza games, and the combat, while all the moves are different because you're playing as a different character, all the kind of the fundamentals of the combat system are the same. So if you have played a Yakuza game, you know what you're in for if you go into Judgment. So don't people should not pick up Judgment thinking like, oh, this is a very different kind of game from that studio. No, like this feels like it is like the Yakuza spin-off game that is set in the same world, doesn't have the characters, but is them trying to do something different within that world and with those kinds of mechanics. So specifically what it is that it is a sort of crime noir sort of story. So you play as Yagami Takayuki, who is played by a very famous actor whose name I'm forgetting now off the top of my head. But he's a very famous TV actor in Japan. And so they got this like really big get for them in terms of the protagonist. And so Takayuki Yagami is a PI who used to be a lawyer. And at the very beginning of the game, you find out that he got his client acquitted for murder, which is extremely, extremely rare in the Japanese legal system. And as soon as he got that client acquitted, they went home that night and killed their girlfriend and burned their apartment down. And so as soon as that happens, Yagami is kind of shamed. He kind of blames himself for this girl, Mio's murder. And then he leaves his lawyer agency and he becomes a private eye. So that's all the stuff you find out kind of in the first 10 minutes of the game. It has this big flashback that shows you that. And that's sort of the setup of the story.
By the way, the actor's name is Takuya Kimura, who was a popular member of SMAP, a boy band, and was also the voice of Hal in Hal's Moving Castle.
There you go. Yes, so Takuya Kimura, who is also... like, the reason why I sometimes have a hard time remembering his name is that in Japan, he's commonly called Kimutaku, to kind of put his name together. And so in Japan, like, if you want to look up YouTube videos of this game, it is actually much easier to type in, if you use a Japanese keyboard, and type in Kimutaku ga Gotoku, which is like Kimura Takuya, basically, instead of Like a Dragon, which is the Japanese title of the Yakuza games. So that's why I can have a hard time remembering his name. But yeah, so he's this big, huge TV star. Like, he's... like, it seriously is kind of like, you know, getting Bryan Cranston fresh off of Breaking Bad to be the star of your game or something like that. Like, it is a very huge get for the Japanese audience.
It's like them getting getting Keanu Reeves for Cyberpunk.
Yes, only instead of him being a side character, he is the main character. And you're just playing as fucking Keanu Reeves. And it's not a thing of, like, where, because he's this big TV movie star in Japan, that they had to skimp on the dialogue or anything. It's not like Kiefer Sutherland in Metal Gear Solid 5, where it felt like they got that guy in for, like, a weekend, and so he has almost no dialogue in the fucking game. It is as much, if not maybe honestly even more dialogue than the Yakuza games. It feels like, you know, all these games do the kind of JRPG thing because there's so much text and content in the game where they kind of have... there's, like, the most important story stuff. This is all fully voiced, fully acted, all that kind of stuff. And then as you kind of go down the rung, eventually get to, this is, like, a side story. It's not going to be voice acted. We'll play, like, little clips of, like, when someone has a line of dialogue that pops up. And it feels like you have way more fully voiced dialogue. I don't know if that's just because it's been a little bit since I played Yakuza Kiwami 2 and I'm misremembering or what, but... this guy has a lot of fucking dialogue in the game, so don't be worried about the TV star thing. and think that that means that they're kind of skimping on that stuff.
Go get all the Kimutaku you want.
Yes, exactly. You're just drenched in this fucking dude. And he's great. And it was something where at first, I think probably the like halfway through chapter one, I was kind of a little bit lukewarm on the game because I hadn't... One, chapter one is very, very slow, and I hadn't kind of gotten the sense of what the game was doing, because there's this weird kind of uncanny valley effect if you've played the Yakuza games, where it is so similar to those games in so many respects that, like, where it's different, it took me a weird time to adjust, because nobody makes games like this. Like, the Yakuza games are completely unique, one of a kind. No other studio makes anything that I can even particularly use as a comparison point. Which makes anyone ever saying, like, oh, it's like Shinmu, or it's like Japanese Grand Theft Auto. Like, no, it is nothing like either of those things. It is so not either of those things. So it took me a lot while to warm up to it, and the game has a lot of different sort of smaller systems that they have incorporated that kind of fill out your kind of private investigator tool set. So they have like lock picking mini games. They have a like tailing mechanic where you follow people around and eavesdrop on them. You have like all these different investigation mechanics where you're picking out pieces of evidence and you're taking pictures, and they have dialogue options that you're trying to sort of like piece through dialogue trees to find like kind of all the right clues and kind of get people to confess and that kind of stuff. And all those systems are fairly basic. You know, this is not LA Noir or anything, but there are a lot of these kinds of systems they've layered on top of the existing Yakuza base. And so that means that chapter one starts very, very slowly because they have to tutorialize you on every single one of these mechanics. And so at first I was just kind of didn't get the sense of like if I was actually going to like what they were doing to change it up. And at first I didn't get a good read on Kimutaku's performance as Yagami, because he plays it way more low-key, and I couldn't tell if that was, like, is he just not fully into this, or is this the character? But by the time you get to Chapter 1, which if people have picked up this game and you are getting that sense of Chapter 1 being slow, make sure you play all the way through Chapter 1 before you decide whether or not the game's for you. Because once you get to the end of Chapter 1, I think everything clicks into place. You have a really cool, really well done trial scene, and kind of the small story that chapter one sets up kind of resolves at the end of chapter one, and they have this good sense of like episodic pacing because of that. And so by the time you get to the end of chapter one, I think I got a much better sort of feel for Yagami as a character. He's a really cool protagonist, and he kind of underplays things very deliberately because he's a very different kind of character from Kiryu. And that's one of the most fun things about this game, is having this like really well-honed team that knows what they're doing, knows how to tell these kinds of stories, sort of taking their craft at a very different kind of protagonist in a very different genre from the Yakuza crime fiction and Kiryu-led stories in the other games. And so it leads to stuff like Yagami is not, you know, this fucking 6'5" like wall of muscle like Kiryu is, who just like you point Kiryu in a direction and he will knock everything down until he punches the dude in the face that he needs to punch to save Haruka or whoever, you know, and you know, with this like strong moral sense of righteousness and is always going to do the right thing and nobody can stop him. It's just a matter of time. Like, that's the kind of like, you know, Yakuza Superman that Kiryu is. And Yagami is not like that. He's this kind of smaller, scrawny guy. He can fight really well. He knows kind of martial arts, and so he can, you know, you can obviously hold your own. But the story definitely crafts scenarios where there's a scenario in chapter one where you have to infiltrate a Yakuza office to get some like evidence and talk to a guy. And if that scene occurred in like Yakuza 0, where there's a similar kind of moment, Kiryu just kicks the fucking door down and goes and just punches everybody in the face and works his way up like 6 floors of this building until he gets like to the main guy he needs to get, and then he rips his fucking shirt off and then he has a dope boss fight. And that's not what Yagami does. Like, Yagami has a little drone with a camera and he scopes it out, and then they call a like maintenance guy and sort of delay the maintenance guy so that Yagami disguises himself as the maintenance dude and works his way into the building and infiltrates it and like has to find the fucking passcode for the building and the door to get to the fourth floor and all this stuff. And so it is much more kind of ingrained, or the genre is much more ingrained into the gameplay than I think I had originally anticipated. And it's cool because it gives a much different sense of tone and pacing and style to what at first blush feels like a very, very similar game to what you've played before if you have played the other Yakuza games. And so that sense of Yagami as this much more vulnerable protagonist from Kiryu changes the feeling of the world in the story so much, and it's really fun. Because Yagami's not, you know, he's not the Dragon of Dojima. Like, he's not this, like, legend, fucking god person that, you know, nobody can stop. He's just another kind of fairly normal dude living and making his way in Kamurocho, which gives you a very different perspective of the world that they've built in all these different games. And so if you are a fan of the Yakuza games, this is a fucking, like, obvious, like, just play this game. I have been having so much fun. All the drama is great. I just got to a part at the end of chapter 4 where there's a really cool development in the murder case, and I'm like really invested in the new cast of characters and in the sort of main murder mystery story that's going on. But you also have all the side cases, and you have lots of really fun, goofy stuff going on in those. You've got a lot of really fun, weird mini games like drone races and all this stuff you can do. If you want to play Virtua Fighter 5, Virtua Fighter 5 is just in here as one of the arcade games, which is awesome. Like, that game is, you know, it's not new, but it's not that old. It's a PS3 game, and you can just play fucking Virtua Fighter 5. There's one of the arcade games, from what I understand it, is an arcade game that has never gotten a home release in any form. So it's some, like, weird Japanese Sega arcade game, so you can play that. So it has all that kind of stuff in it also. I'm just having such a fantastic time with it. And I guess the last point I want to make about it, in terms of the side cases and the sub-story, like, the side story kind of stuff, is it reminds me a lot of the way that Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth felt in terms of its, like, balance of different kinds of tones and characters and weird stuff going on, but it all being centered around you, like, going back to your office, looking at a bulletin board, like, and picking up a case and following it that way. So instead of the sub-stories being things that you just run into the world the way that you did with Kiryu and the other games, these are much more contextualized in you are a private eye and they are coming to you to work a case. And that tone, like, I've been thinking a lot about Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth while I've been playing some of the side stuff in this game, and if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that that is a very, very positive thing.
Yeah, fuck you for making that comparison, because now I have to play this fucking game.
Yep, that's one of the reasons why I made it.
Because, Sean, I have to ask you, you said this is, if you're a Yakuza fan, play this game. Let's say I am someone who has always wanted to play Yakuza, maybe doesn't want to commit to playing 7 50-hour games. Would Judgment be a good one-off to dip your toes into?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there's nothing about this game that you need to have known anything about any of the other games to play. Like, it's the kind of thing where if you have played a bunch of the Yakuza games or, like, touched them a bunch, like, never liked them, I don't think this is a game that's going to, like, convince you that these games are for you. But if you have not played any of those games, this is a perfect jumping-on point. It feels totally self-contained. Again, I have not seen anything direct. Like, there's not been a single character from Yakuza that has crossed over so far. And I imagine that probably continues. I hope that Kiryu has, like, a cameo somewhere. I hope that at the end of the game there's some weird side thing where he shows up, because I really want Yagami to talk to Kiryu at least a little bit. But other than that, I feel like if they put that in there, that would be the only thing they would have that would be some direct connection to the other games.
That is good to hear. I am looking forward to, I don't know when the fuck I will, because July is really crazy busy for games, but at some point I would like to check this out, and, you know, it'll probably be on sale in the next month or two, so looking forward to that.
And I want to also make it clear that, like, these games are not, like, absurdly long unless you want to do everything in them. So, like, if you only want to do, like, some of the side stuff and some of the mini games, but, like, kind of more mainline the story, these games are only, like, 15 to 20 hours long. It's only if you're like, no, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to level up every single skill, and I'm going to fucking do all the home run challenges at the batting center, and I'm going to spend, like, 2 hours playing fucking poker in the weird underground casino. You know, it's only if you're doing all of that that you get to the, you know, beginning of Chapter 5 and are 25 hours into the game.
Well, that does sound like a lot of fun. This week spent some time playing the Spider-Man DLC, the Insomniac game, and because I played Far From Home, or I watched Far From Home, and I got in my car and I was pumped. I'm like, this game is fucking awesome. And before I start my car, I'm checking Twitter. And on Twitter, Insomniac has announced, oh, all the new costumes from Far From Home are in our new are in our game now. And I'm like, fuck yeah, I love the new costumes in Far From Home. So I want to play with that. And, oh, there's this DLC I haven't played yet. So I went home, I bought the DLC, the $25 season pass, played the DLC, and I don't know how to recommend this DLC.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of fun with it, but I had fun with it for all 3 days it took me to 100% everything in the DLC. Every trophy, if the counter reads 100%, I did everything. 3 days. I think it is definitely overpriced at $25. Like, yes. In a world where Witcher 3 has done what it's done with DLC, and Nintendo did all that Breath of the Wild DLC for just $20, and that was two full packs, including the whole Champions Ballad campaign. $25 is kind of ridiculous. I would say this should be $15 max, because those three DLCs together are very small. It's very slight. What you get, there's nothing new that was not in the original game. In the third DLC, I do think there are some new areas. They're small, but there's some underground stuff that was not in the base game. But other than that, there's like no new areas. There's no new mechanics. You do get some new suits. There's obviously new story stuff, and it's good. It's not as good as the main game. It does kind of feel like a B team wrote it to me a little bit. Just like the quality of the quips is like here when maybe it was here up higher before. But it's good. It's fine. You get stuff with Black Cat, which is fun. You get stuff with Yuri Watanabe and then with Silver Sable in the last one. I don't think it all coheres as well as it could. And all of the stuff with Yuri, which is the best part of the DLC, turns out to be 100% sequel bait. And that pissed me off because I wanted resolution to that, and there is none. But it is, here's how I would recommend it. If you loved Insomniac Spider-Man, like you and I did, and you, platinumed the original game, totally. Play it. It is more Spider-Man. That's awesome. Maybe see if there's going to be a sale at some point. Because I will say, the one thing it does exceptionally well is combat. Because that DLC, all of them, they just decide, the game got pretty hard by the end of the original. Let's go fucking crazy with it. And so, by the third DLC, there's encounters where I feel like you're fighting 200 guys. And it's probably not actually that, but that's what it feels like. And it really forces you to use all of your Spidey mechanics. We talked about this at length when we reviewed the base game. The combat in Spider-Man that was really the surprise of the game for everyone, I think. We all knew the web shooting was going to be fun, but the actual combat being as good as it is, in the DLC, you're having to use so many different moves to get through these fights. It felt like Mass Effect at a certain point, where I've got my ability wheel, and I'm spinning it to be like, okay, let's use this now, and because the ability wheel kind of slows down the game, and electric web, and then I really loved the screwball challenges, which is this character who's a social media addict who's making you do all these fun challenges, and she has these gadget challenges, which I wish there were more of, because they're really cool, where she makes use two gadgets, and I learned all these cool combo mechanics, where my new favorite one to use is you use your big web bomb and it gets everyone webbed up, and then you use the impact shooter to just throw them at walls. And I also learned it's really easy to just use your impact shooter on rooftops to just throw people off the roof and I guess murder them, because I don't know how Spidey saves those people.
No, there's little web things shoot out and attach them to the side of buildings. You can watch, and they don't fall to the street and just die.
But in my head, they kind of do.
I mean, you can web someone to a car that that's a car that's about to explode, and then that car will explode, and that person's almost certainly dead, but you can't chuck them off of buildings. Don't worry.
Yes. So anyway, just the combat, it pushes the combat, up to 11, and I really liked that about it. It's, it is not, I think on the scale of DLC from Horse Armor to Witcher 3, it's somewhere in the dead center of that, which is, it's fine. It is the game, but a little tiny slice more of it. It's overpriced, but if you like Spider-Man, it's worth it. And I got to play in all the cool new suits, and there's a lot of cool new suits. I actually think what they call the stealth suit, which is Spider-Man's new black suit from Far From Home that he has in the middle of the movie, looks better in the game than it did in the movie. It's so fucking good. I used the stealth suit through the entire first DLC where you're doing stuff with Black Cat, because I felt like,
nice,
this looks like a cat burglar costume. I love this. So it's really fun.
Yeah, I agree with you basically everything you had to say about the DLC. That it's something that I would, even if you really like Marvel Spider-Man, unless you just need that Spider-Man high immediately because you just watched the movie, wait for it to be on sale, because it is definitely, like, that's the biggest thing about it to me, is that it's just overpriced. Like, if it was much cheaper, I wouldn't mind that it's very slim. And for me, like, you know, it came packaged with the PS4 Pro version I got, so it's like I didn't pay any extra money to get that game, or to get the season pass. So it, like, it wasn't really a factor for me personally, but I can definitely imagine if you're someone that was like sort of on the edge about it, and then you paid $25 for that, that you'd be kind of pissed off about it. So I would recommend, yeah, waiting for it to be on sale. But it is, if you like that game a lot, it is a lot of fun, and there are some pretty fun story moments and cool little character beats. Like, I like a lot of the stuff with Black Cat in the first pass, or the first part particularly. That's also another thing, is it's all like basically one big thing. Like, people should not, like, don't just be like, oh, I only care about Silver Sable, so I'll get the Silver Sable one. That's not how it works. Like, they're basically one big thing.
Yeah, they're separated into three campaigns, but, like, they literally end with a big to-be-continued message.
Yeah.
So, it's, it's, you know, and there's things that kind of go unresolved. I feel like the whole DLC ends on a weird anti-climax where you fight Hammerhead for the second time, and maybe he's defeated, but it's not 100% clear because the DLC just kind of cuts to black. It's weird, but it is fun. I liked getting to know some of the characters more. Mary Jane kind of drops out of the DLC near the end, which was weird. I don't know if that's a setup for something in the sequel, but anyway, it's, you know, it's fun, and you do get some very cute moments where Miles Morales is calling you on the phone and wanting to train, and it gets a little repetitive, but also I love Miles Morales, so there's some very good teases for the next game there.
Yeah, it kind of, honestly, like, some of it reminds me of, like, anime filler in this way of, like, we can't really move the main story forward, obviously, because they're not going to assume that people have played this DLC when they put their Spider-Man 2 out. So it's like everything on, like, the MJ Miles level has to be kind of frozen a little bit. So all of their stuff just kind of repeats these little cycles. And it's only, like, the smaller, like, you know, side characters that are featured in the DLC that feels like their stories are significant.
Yes. One other piece of stuff I want to talk about before we finish today is the Criterion Barnes & Noble Summer Sale is going on right now. So you can get all the Criterion Collection discs for 50% off at Barnes & Noble. I've picked up a couple. I picked up Blue Velvet, the new David Lynch release, which is gorgeous and awesome. And they are slowly but surely building a really good David Lynch collection. They have Eraserhead, Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks Firewalk, and now Blue Velvet. I really want them to do Inland Empire, because that movie is out of fucking print, like, hardcore. But anyway, I also picked up the Kobayashi movie Samurai Rebellion with Mifune, which I've never seen.
That's a good movie. That's okay, a good one. Yeah.
I'm excited to watch it. The new War and Peace set they did that I'm very, very excited to check out, but I haven't yet. But, of course, the big one was my beautiful boy, Police Story, Jackie Chan. Sean, buy this. It is so good. This set is so awesome. It is, if you haven't heard, Criterion did a set of Police Story 1 and 2. You can get it on sale for like $20 at Barnes & Noble. It's the best $20 you'll spend this summer, because Police Story and Police Story 2 are really good fucking movies.
Yep.
And holy crap, I didn't know these movies could look this good, Sean. The Blu-ray is unbelievably gorgeous. It sounds great as well, and there's a variety of audio options. I just like the original Cantonese mono. But man, like, because those movies have had a, let's say, checkered release history in the United States.
Yeah.
So this is like they went. This is like in Hong Kong. They went back to the original negatives. Did a full 4K restoration. Looks fucking gorgeous. Love it. The movies are great. It's absolutely loaded with special features. Like, I don't know if you can see it through the camera, Sean, how thick the text of special features is. But yeah, there's a ton here, including like a full hour long documentary that is from, I think, the 90s or something, about Jackie Chan's stunt team and things like that. There's a whole feature I'm really excited to watch about Beijing opera training, which is how Jackie Chan and a lot of the stuntmen in Hong Kong at the time kind of came up and were trained. And yeah, it's just, I watched Police Story 1 the other night. That movie is so balls to the wall, crazy and weird, and I love it. And it also has one of my like five favorite movie endings of all time. And I'm not even talking about, like, the last 10 minutes are all great, leading up to one of the best stunts in film history, where he goes down the pole with all the lights. But do you remember the very end of Police Story, Sean?
I can't recall it off the top of my head.
It's where they've arrested all the bad guys, but Jackie doesn't, like, want to stop, and they're like, stop, Jackie, stop, and they've got him restrained, but he just breaks out and just fucking wails on the bad guys, including, like, the main drug dealer. He just starts punching in the stomach, like, like it's fucking Dragon Ball, and then the movie ends freeze frame, like, blurry freeze frame with, like, the cops trying to hold Jackie back.
Right, yeah.
Such, and then it goes into the theme song that Jackie sings himself. It's so good. Sean, you should pick this setup, and then I really want to do a Police Story episode at some point.
Okay, yeah, sure. I am down. I'm down for that.
Just, like, get this so we can do Police Story 1 and 2, because I would love to do that someday. It's so good. And now I'm trying to find Police Story 3 was redone over here as Super Cop. Like, they completely re-edited it. It's, like, shorter here. They changed all the music and sound effects and obviously the voices. So I think you can only get the, like, real version of Police Story 3 from, like, Hong Kong itself. So I'm trying to find a good, like, disc of that, because I'd love to see that someday, too. That's the one with Michelle Yeoh, I think, is in that one. But anyway, Criterion, you have been doing the Lord's work these last couple of years. They've slowly but surely started doing Chinese movies. And they need to do more, because they've done a couple of the King Hu films. They've done a couple Edward Yangs. They've done this. I would love them to do more, because that is still, for, like, North American distribution, a pretty poor area of distribution. Yeah. It's like Hong Kong and Hong Kong, obviously, mainland China is even worse. But, like, Hong Kong and Taiwan, we're getting slowly more and more of that. So, very happy this is out.
Yeah, I want them to just find some way to just get a huge Jackie Chan box set, because they're, like, watching Jackie Chan movies is such a frustrating process, because there's, like, all these different versions and cuts and titles for it. It's, like, trying to keep, like, track of what you've seen and what version of it you've seen and what, like, all that. It's very, very hard to be a fan of his stuff and, like, try to get some of his older movies and figure out what the fuck even some of them are, because they have, like, three or four titles, you know?
I don't know if Criterion will be doing more anytime soon, but Masters of Cinema in the UK has been doing a bunch of these. They did Police Story 1 and 2. I think those are different masters, but, like, similar level of quality. I know they did Drunken Master recently, and I'm definitely going to import that, because that movie has always been impossible to find. They've been doing a bunch of those, and the UK generally is much better about Asian cinema. They have a lot more of it than we have over here, which is one of the reasons I have a region-free Blu-ray player, is just to get some of that stuff in here. But, yeah, I'll have to look it up. This is all Criterion has so far. If this sells well, I hope it convinces them to do more. Because now they have a relationship with Fortune Star, which is the company that does all of these in Hong Kong. And I'm just like, please, please do more. Fingers crossed. Get that Drunken Master out here.
Yes, because that's one of those ones where The Legend of the Drunken Master that came out over here is the second one of those movies. It's just like, God damn it. Like, have I even seen the first one? I just don't even know at some point.
Because it's like, isn't it Operation Condor that they did reversed?
Yeah, it's like Operation Condor and Armor of God, yeah, where they're flipped which order they come in over here. And obviously, like, a lot of the editing and, like, dialogue can be different. It's fucking obnoxious. It's so annoying to be a fan of Kung Fu movies, and Jackie Chan's in particular.
Yes. So anyway, very good. There's also a feature on here from, like, 2014 where he performed the theme song live. And I'm excited to watch that.
Nice.
And, like, he reunites with the original Jackie Chan stunt team, and they perform on stage. It's just, it is a beautiful collection. It's also, like, all this, like, artwork, like, painted artwork of him from the movie. I fucking love that. If you open it up, like, there's new poster art for the two movies. It's, if you've never seen these movies, they are insane. They are literally insane movies. They were made by lunatics. And, like, Police Story 1 begins with them, like, demolishing a shanty town. It's fucking crazy. I love it.
Yeah, those movies are fantastic. And it's one of those things where maybe the most impressive stunt work in all of those movies is just the extended phone answering sequence from the middle of Police Story 1. So,
it's so good.
Yeah.
All right. I have a couple pieces of news for us, Sean.
All right.
First one. You alluded to this game earlier. Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth is coming to Switch. It is called Digimon Cyber Sleuth Complete Edition. It's going to come out October 18th, 2019. I think that's a worldwide release to Switch. It includes both Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth and Cyber Sleuth Hacker's Memory. These were previously on PS4 and Vita, and I bought them twice on Vita and PS4 so I could cross-play. Now they're going to be on Switch. You can do both. It's a two-pack with both games for $49.99, so good price on that, too, I think. And, yeah, if you've never played these games, Switch will be the perfect platform for these. I will probably buy them again. I am very excited that this is happening. And at the same event, Bandai Namco also announced that a new Digimon story is in development. It's not a Cyber Sleuth game. It's like the next generation. So we have that to look forward to as well.
Yes. Also important that if you don't have a Switch, they're also coming to PC. So if you...
Oh,
if,
cool.
Yeah. So if you don't have any of the platforms it's already on or the Switch, you could also get the PC version. Those games are fucking great. Mm-hmm. If you have any love of Digimon, you absolutely should play them. Even if you don't, you should play them anyways.
I didn't know a fucking thing about Digimon, Sean. I couldn't tell you an Agumon from a Gabumon.
That's literally the exact joke that I was about to make, Jonathan. Good job.
All right, see? This is the point. You, a lifelong Digimon fan, were about to make a joke, and I, a fan because of Cyber Sleuth, made that joke.
Exactly.
You can be like me, too. Our final piece of news, Sean. The Flash movie got a new set of writers and directors this week.
I didn't even hear about this. Are you fucking kidding me?
It did. Sean, I did some research this week. Would you like me to walk you through the saga of Warner Brothers trying to create a Flash movie?
Please do, because we've obviously talked about this each time this shit has changed, but I have no memory of how the bizarre labyrinthine path we have taken to this moment. So go ahead.
Because I have also counted the number of writers and directors attached to this movie.
All right.
All right. Our tale begins in July of 2013. This is, I believe, when Batman v Superman was announced, and this was around the time of Man of Steel. This is when they were gearing up to do the DC Universe. And in July 2013, Greg Berlanti, who is the guy behind the DC stuff on the CW, was announced to be developing it. So he is writer number one. A year later, October 2014, The Flash is announced for a 2018 theatrical release, the first script being written by Greg Berlanti, Chris Brancato, Michael Green, and Mark Guggenheim, who become writers 2, 3, and 4. In April 2015, a new story treatment is written by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller from 21 Jump Street, Lego Movie, all of that, with the intention that they would also direct. So they become writers number 5 and 6, and directors number 1 and 2. Between 2016 and 2017, Seth Graham Smith, the writer of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, and Rick Famuyiwa both separately sign on and drop out as director. They become directors number 3 and 4. They also both write separate drafts of the script, writers number 7 and number 8. January 2017, Joby Harold is hired to do a page 1 rewrite of the script, which previously had drafts written by Graham Smith and Fumiyawa. He is writer number 9. In July 2017, at Comic-Con, the title of the film is announced as Flashpoint. In March 2018, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, who made that film Game Night that everyone loved, including me, that's a great film. They are hired to co-direct. They are directors number 5 and number 6. Dan Mazou is hired to co-write. He is writer number 10. Seth Graham Smith and Greg Brancato, writers number 7 and number 2 respectively, come back to also work on the script. At this stage, just as an aside, listed producers on the project are Zack Snyder, Alex Gartner, Jeff Johns, Dan Mazur, Richard Suckle, Deborah Snyder, Phil Lord, Chris Miller, John Berg, Denise DeNovi, and Michael Disco.
Yeah, and it's just important to note that this is the time where Lord and Miller left the movie to go beyond Star Wars, then got kicked off of Star Wars, they got Ron Howard to finish Star Wars Solo, A Star Wars Story, and then that movie has come out.
Yes. At some point before March of 2019... Daly and Goldstein, the announced directors, also start contributing to the screenwriting process, becoming at this stage writers number 11 and number 12. March 2019. Following creative differences with Daly and Goldstein's work on the script, Ezra Miller, the actor who is going to play The Flash, is hired to co-write an entirely new draft with comics writer Grant Morrison. Did you even hear this happen, Sean?
No, I didn't know, I'm a fan of some of Grant Morrison's stuff. All-Star Superman is one of my favorite comic books. I don't think Grant Morrison should be trying to write a script for a big-budget Hollywood movie. Everyone would hate the movie that Grant Morrison would write. He is not a, mainstream fucking writer.
Yep. Well, they become writers 13 and 14. And, yes, this summer they wrote a new draft of The Flash, which brings us to July 2019. We learn that Daly and Goldstein are now off the project, and the studio has rejected the Miller-Morrison script.
Yeah, because fucking Grant Morrison wrote it for, like, Grant Morrison is a maniac. He's cool in comic books. He has no business writing a movie that probably will cost like $100 million fucking dollars to make, you know?
Also, Ezra Miller's the actor. He's not a fucking writer. All right. Ugh. So now this week, Andy Muschietti, the director of It and the upcoming It Chapter 2, is brought on as director number 7, and Christina Hodson, the writer of Bumblebee and the upcoming Birds of Prey movie, Bumblebee was great, and that Birds of Prey movie has good hype behind it, she becomes writer number 15, and she is tasked to do a page one rewrite, which means she is starting from the very beginning all over again. Warner says they are looking at a January start date, which, lol.
Yeah, so, sure you are.
15 writers, 7 directors, and I want to point out that in the time since this project began, the Flash TV series on the CW was created, completed 5 seasons, made 114 episodes, and at least 7 different crossover events with Arrow, Supergirl, and Legends of Tomorrow, and the upcoming Batwoman. Nobody involved in this show except Greg Berlanti has been asked to help on the film project.
I mean, it's also like... like, since this project, the Flash movie, was announced, Ben Affleck has been Batman and left as Batman. Like,
yes.
What the fuck are they doing?
Look, a lot of time, this is not, like, unheard of for movies to go through development hell, but it's the Flash. It's not that hard. Like, that's why I pointed out the thing about the TV show is just, like, they've made 100 episodes in the time these chuckle fucks have been trying to get one script together that is good enough to shoot. Like, this just shows you how fucked up DC's whole development process is. They've got nobody there who knows the first fucking thing about comic books or superheroes or anything, so they're just, like, grasping at straws, like, hey, you're the star of the movie, you want to write it? Go ahead. We'll give you some money. It's ridiculous. 15 writers and 7 directors. That is hilarious. And the Andy Muschietti and Christina Hodson thing, like, those are by far the two most, I would say, high-profile. Well, no, Phil Lord and Chris Miller were pretty high-profile. But, like, since then, they're probably the most high-profile people asked to do this. And Andy Muschietti has done, like, It was a huge hit for Warner Brothers. And It Chapter 2 probably will be as well. So, like, that's a big, like, hire for them. But also, I don't know why you're getting a horror director to do The Flash. It's just, like, I don't know. Christina Hodson's a good writer. If anyone could pull it off, she could, but, like, it doesn't seem like the studio knows what it wants. I'm sure several of those scripts were good. You write 15 scripts, one of them's going to be good, right?
Yeah, because I think that's the thing, is it just feels like... I suspect maybe one of the sort of things that has happened is, like, the DC movie brand has, like, changed directions 3 or 4 times since this movie got announced. And so, you know, you have all this weird stuff where, you get, like, they have a new Batman that's going to be in, like, its own Batman, like, the Batman seems like that's just its own thing. It has nothing to do with the rest of this stuff. You know, Justice League had, Zack Snyder had to leave that movie, and so then you had Joss Whedon come on and finish it and change the tone of that movie. Like, Wonder Woman was very successful, so they're making a sequel to that. But then they also had Shazam that came out, and that's completely its own thing. And then Aquaman came out. That is technically, like, the Aquaman guy, but seems like it's basically, like, kind of... like, it's just so disparate that it feels like probably one of the things is the mission statement for what the Flash movie needs to be. Especially when you think about it, at one point it was going to be called Flashpoint. That, like, the mission statement for this movie has changed so much that they just had to reject the script, because you can't make a movie that was supposed to be the thing that ties, like, the weird future vision shit in Batman v Superman and, like, Justice League and Darkseid together. That, like, that movie can't happen anymore, because Justice League was shit, Batman v Superman was shit, but Justice League, like, was shit and it really bombed. And so, you know, this movie just, like, is cast to the winds and flying in every given direction. And maybe they will actually make it someday. Probably not. By the time they do make it, is Ezra Miller still going to want to be the Flash? Who knows? They scrapped his script, so maybe not.
Maybe not. Yeah, we'll see. I really desperately want to see what the hell that Flashpoint script was, because it's a pretty open secret they were going to use it to, like, change the universe. And by the time they had a script for it, it's also an open secret that their movies were just bombing and, like, no one wanted it to be a universe. So they had, because, like, now the internal direction is they're not doing crossover stuff anymore. Like, they are letting every movie be its own continuity, basically like DC was before they tried this.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I think is probably the smart approach at this point, because they failed really badly at doing it the other way. So, but who knows? I had a lot of fun writing up that fucking summary, because what a clusterfuck that has been.
Yeah, and now I just desperately want to see what that fucking Grant Morrison script is going to be, because they must have looked at that script and been like, you want us to spend money on this? Like Grant Morrison is the dude who, when he wrote Animal Man, Animal Man met Grant Morrison in that comic book. Like, he plays weird with, like, continuity and meta bullshit. So the idea of him writing a script for a big Hollywood movie is utterly hilarious to me.
I want to see that now.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the news. Let's go ahead and move on, Sean. You want to talk some Spider-Man?
Let's talk about Spider-Man Far From Home.
Before we get into spoilers, do you just want to give some general reactions to this movie?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I liked it a lot. I think it's, you know, Marvel is still fucking nailing it. You know, we talked about it a little bit with at the end of Endgame, and when we talked about the Summer Slump stuff last week, about, like, you know, will Marvel be able to keep this up? Like, what happens now that we have, you know, spoilers from Endgame, I guess. If you know, everyone knows at this point Iron Man's dead, Captain America has moved on. Like, how does that kind of change the playing field, and how does that affect this movie? And I think they really nailed it of, this movie feels like it exists in the wake of Endgame. It deals with the stuff from Endgame, but it also manages to be its own movie and its own story about Peter and Spider-Man. And so that is the thing I think I appreciate the most about this movie, is just this way that it sort of is able to fit into this really essential part in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though it's a low-key, really important part. But it also does a lot to further this version of Peter Parker that we met in Civil War, and in following his journey along the way. I think they absolutely nail it with Mysterio. He is fucking awesome. They do everything perfect with Mysterio. You really can't ask for a better version of that character done on film. And I think this movie has a really strong grasp of the kind of different themes that it juggles about, like mentorship, you know, coming of age and kind of coming to your own, about, like, relationships, and it's kind of dealing with a lot of that kind of teen drama stuff that Homecoming did, but I think it probably nails it even better than that movie. So,
yeah,
I like it a lot.
I loved it. I've actually seen it twice. I saw it Tuesday and then Thursday. I wasn't planning to go see it again so quick, but I wound up having a coupon, and it was July 4th, and the theater was selling dollar hot dogs, and I was hungry, and I wanted to go see a movie, and nothing else was going on here, so I went and saw it again, and the hot dog was good, and the movie was good, and they also give you free popcorn on Thursdays. So, anyway, it was a good day at the movies, and I've seen it twice, and I loved it both times. You know, it's not a particularly deep Spider-Man movie in the way that I think Spider-Man 2 or Spider-Verse are.
Yeah.
Like, those are in a different caliber, but this is really, really good. It is, I don't know if there's a more purely fun Spider-Man movie than this one. And just, like, it is so creative. It makes such good use of, like, the Marvel license, but not in a way that feels like cloying or like it's overtaking the movie. It's everything you said, I agree with completely. It's also just, it's a really inventive movie. It takes Spider-Man around Europe, and it has a lot of fun with the different settings, and it feels like every action sequence is the kind of thing we have not seen Spider-Man do on film before, and I think that's a breath of fresh air, because this is the 8th theatrical Spider-Man movie. So, like, it's really good that I think they mixed things up. I think the director of this movie, John Watts, took a huge step up, because I've said before, Homecoming, I don't think it's a bad movie by any means. I was definitely underwhelmed by it, because I think Homecoming is, it's a good TV pilot. I'm not sure it's a movie. Like, it's kind of cheap. The action is really bad. It's got great performances and a really cool villain with Michael Keaton. I think it's a little scatterbrained. I think it's a little too heavy on the Marvel tie-ins. I think Far From Home has the perfect balance of all of that, and it doesn't feel like a TV thing. It feels like this is a movie. It's got really great just, like, sense of, like, it's not, like, visually masterful or anything, but it's got a really good sense of, like, geographic space in action sequences. It's very creative in how it does action. It's got one absolute dynamite killer scene near the end that is basically out of a Batman Rocksteady game. We will talk about that later.
Yep.
And, like, that is one of the best things the MCU has done on film. Like, this is top-tier MCU to me. This is top 10 of the movies they've made. I don't know if it's, like, inner circle top 5, but definitely top 10. I agree, Mysterio, they couldn't have done it any better. And it's got the best post-credits scene Marvel has ever done by leaps and bounds. And actually, spoilers for Spider-Man Far From Home. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. J.K. Simmons is in this movie as J. Jonah Jameson, and I had no idea.
Yep.
And when he comes up on screen, I was with like the opening night crowd, and I missed his first line of dialogue because we all went, "What?" Like, just verbally. I have not had that moment in a theater for so long. Sean, what was your reaction to our Lord and Savior, J.K. Simmons, returning as J. Jonah Jameson in this movie?
I think I literally made the Home Alone face. Like, I literally, like, Macaulay Culkin, like, both hands on the side of my face, which is not, like, that's not, like, a thing I ever do. And it just had this moment of, like, what is happening? What? And I was like, I didn't say anything because I was watching the movie with my dad because that's, you know, that's, we go and watch all these Marvel movies together. I was just like, oh, my brain was on fire. Like, it's that thing where everybody wants it to happen. Everybody's, like, been saying it just, it's, you know, you, I mean, it's, and it's clearly the reason why they never fucking had J. Jonah Jameson in Homecoming was just like, well, what do you do? Like, and it's that thing of, like, it feels like there is, like, this unspoken thing of that you can't cast the guy again in this totally different continuity, movies that have nothing to do with the Raimi movies, that are in, like, this, like, whole cinematic universe. Like, it just felt like you can't just, like, break that. You're breaking some sort of, it's not the fourth wall, but the some wall is being broken down when you do that. And then they just said, fuck it, let's just do it, apparently. And it's, yeah, like, this had to happen. Like, it needed to be this way. Because you can't do Spider-Man and have no J. Jonah Jameson. You can't have J. Jonah Jameson be in a movie and have it not be J.K. Simmons. And so at some point, something had to give, and the right thing gave, and J.K. Simmons, it's just a little cameo in the post-credits scene, but he is in this fucking movie, and I just was, like, physically giddy while it was happening.
I know, like, we'll get to the rest of the movie. The rest of the movie is great, but I have been on pins and needles wanting to talk about that scene because, like, if you asked me to sit down and make my ultimate wish list for things I wanted in the MCU, number one, top of the list, would be J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson. He needs to be canonized in the MCU, and he is, and I feel like I'm good. They can shut it down. They did everything I wanted. They did it. And I don't want them to because I want them to do more with him, but, like, oh, man, because it is a little cameo, but it's a little cameo where he gets to say, Spider-Man, like, really angrily. He gets to fucking just straight up out Peter Parker as Spider-Man. Like, it is the cameo you would want for J. Jonah Jameson. Mm-hmm. And then it's also, like, it's such a good cliffhanger. It is such a fucking mic drop of an ending to do, like, the balls on what they do in that last scene. I want Spider-Man Home Away From Home, whatever they call the next one. I want it right now. Good God, that last scene is good.
Yeah, it is something where, because it's one of the things that's really, like, I think it's fun to think about this movie, as it is for a lot of the MCU movies, but particularly the Spider-Man movies, because they're very, the two Spider-Man movies are very, like, immersed in the MCU, compared to something like Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok that have a lot of MCU elements but are kind of on their own, or like Guardians. Like, the Spider-Man movies are in the fucking middle of it. And this one is really interesting because it is this denouement, as we kind of talked about, that it would have to be two Endgame and deals with the traumas left over from the end of that movie. But then, you know, as you need to in any serialized format, like, it also has to pass the torch down to, like, what is the next thing going to be? Like, we need something to look forward to. And I saw the movie yesterday on Saturday, and was in completely unspoiled, which I'm, like, very, I knew that people were very excited about the post-credits scene, but I had no idea that it was going to be something like that. And so, because I thought it would just be like, oh, like, here, in fact, one thought I had was, oh, maybe, like, Tobey Maguire has a cameo appearance with, like, the multiverse shit or something happens. Like, that was my theory of, like, maybe that's the thing that got people really fucking excited. And it just even occurred to me that this would be something they could do, is just have fucking J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson. And so, yeah, having that be this, like, big spark at the end of the movie to be like, okay, yeah, no, we are not done with the MCU. I need to see more of these fucking movies. I need to see what the fuck happens at, like, the next second after the end of that scene for Spider-Man.
Absolutely. And just, you know, one more second on J.K. Simmons. It's occurred to me that, like, you know, all of Spider-Man media cannot get away from J.K. Simmons in this role. Because even in, like, the Insomniac game, it's not J.K. Simmons, but that person is doing a J.K. Simmons impression. And a really good one. But, yeah, like, on the TV shows, like Spectacular Spider-Man, dude's doing a J.K. Simmons impression. He's drawn like J.K. Simmons. And then this follow-up show to that, Ultimate Spider-Man, just cast J.K. Simmons doing the voice. He's in that show. So, like, you can't get away from it. It's, like, the one unrecastable role in superhero media. Like, I think we could all sooner accept a new Iron Man than we could a new J. Jonah Jameson. While J.K. Simmons lives and breathes, that role is his, and it will be his, and they finally put him in. And I also think, because I'm not sure where the room is in these movies for, like, Peter to be working at the Daily Bugle, but doing it like this, which is also how the game does it, where he is, like, a radio podcast, almost like a weird Alex Jones kind of figure, that's perfect. Like, yeah, that, and because it also means J.K. Simmons doesn't have to be there for a month of shooting. They can get him in for a couple days on a green screen. I think this works, and it's a good template going forward for, like, again, Spider-Man, Home is Where the Heart Is, or whatever the next one is.
Yes, yeah, it's like one of the most severe reactions I've had to a movie in a movie theater. It is like, I mean, although honestly, like, I also had, you know, not the same kind of reaction, but I also had a very severe reaction to the end of Godzilla King of the Monsters because I'm a Godzilla guy too. But that this was next tier, like, what the fuck? Like, this was like, you know, if Keanu Reeves coming out at E3 and the E3 announcer saying, on the stage, Keanu Reeves, and the Keanu Reeves telling us all that we're breathtaking, if that's a 10, this is an 11.
I agree. Yes, that's a good way to put it. That's a really good way to put it. So let's talk about the movie leading up to that, because there's so much good stuff. I also noticed watching it a second time, it is a tight movie.
Yeah.
It's 129 minutes with all the post-credits stuff, and because there's two post-credit scenes that are both big and long.
Yeah.
And all the credits. So I think before you get to the credits, it's less than 120 minutes. It feels like it's got plenty of time. It feels like it breathes, but this sucker moves. And I really like that about it. But they pack in a ton of stuff because just on the level of characters, you've got Spider-Man, Ned, all the kids. You've got Aunt May, Happy Hogan, Jon Favreau. You've got Mysterio. You've got Sam Jackson, Colby Smulders as Maria Hill and Nick Fury.
There's like Mysterio's sort of like cast of goons that he has, yes, helping him out.
Yeah, so you've got all of those. You've got, they're not characters, but you do have the big, fun elemental designs, which are clearly inspired by different, like, Spider-Man villains.
Sandman
that are never,
and Hydra Man and Molten Man, yeah. They did a good job on those things.
Yes. So, like, there's a ton in this movie. I don't think anyone was underserved, and I actually think, like, I don't know if Aunt May is in this one less or more than the last one. I thought she was better used here, because mm-hmm. there's just, she's not in it a ton, but there's, like, a really fun, like, familial thing going on there, and I love the idea of Happy Hogan and her getting together, and I desperately want the Spider-Man sequel where Peter has to deal with Happy Hogan as his new stepdad. That'd be so good.
Although I think, like, the payoff to that relationship at the end of Peter sitting, yes, them down and Aunt May being like, oh, it's just a fling, and Happy Hogan's like, yeah, no, we're dating, and, like, that, yeah, that, it's, because that's the thing that I really love about this movie and Homecoming is they have this very, like, teen John Hughes kind of energy to it, and, like, that, it's one of the things that sets these movies apart from other Spider-Man movies and other MCU movies is they get that, like, high school teen drama, mm-hmm. like, comedy thing really, really well. And that's one of the tools I think they use to help them balance all the different characters is, like, that tone is useful for being able to have, like, you know, Ned is definitely not in this movie as much as he is in Homecoming, but he still feels really valuable and important because they know what to do with him and they can play with that character in fun ways.
Yeah, and I'm forgetting ones. Like, their teachers are Martin Starr and J.B. Smoove, yes, who fucking steal the show up until J.K. Simmons comes in. They are so funny. Both times, like, there's this because this is the other thing. This movie, I think, is the funniest MCU movie. Mm-hmm. I probably have previously said that about Thor Ragnarok and Guardians 2. I think this one takes the cake for me, just in terms of sheer laughs. Because there's, like, I mean, Martin Starr is a world-class A-plus comedian to begin with, but there is the scene where it's just a little cutaway, it must have been improvised, where he's playing with the camera and he's trying to take a selfie. And the physical comedy there of him trying to take the camera, and when he does, you know he's going to drop it into the water. You know that's going to be the gag. And he keeps not doing it until the moment where he absolutely should not be doing it. there's such good comic timing and like physical comedy in this movie. And then J.B. Smoove has like 7 lines and they're all killer and hilarious.
Yeah.
I just every performance in this, little, big, whatever, is so well calibrated and it all fits together so well, and it is just on the level of sheer entertainment, it's so good.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I probably laugh harder at Thor Ragnarok, but I think Far From Home has like the most consistent comic sort of like tone and feel to it for sure.
Yeah, it's because again, this sucker just moves because they're on the European trip like 10 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
You've got that very brief opening with Mysterio, then you're with Spidey basically. Here's one thing I do want to talk about. The movie opens with Spidey at the event for Aunt May. I did like the little nod that Aunt May is working with the homeless. Mm-hmm. That's very nice. And Spidey's there. We totally skipped over Aunt May learning Peter is Spider-Man. I don't know if that bothers me, but I do kind of want the mini-movie where like Marissa Tomei has to play that reaction.
Yes, yeah, because that was the stinger at the end of Homecoming, was her walking in on Peter and finding it out. But yes, we don't like see that in detail, which makes sense for like a movie, but yeah, I agree. Like if they still did those like Marvel one shots or whatever they were on the Blu-rays, that would be one I would like to see is what happens with like what's like the dinner conversation the night that she finds out he's Spider-Man, right?
Yes, because like I like the place they wind up with it where she is totally cool with it, and she's not even like being overprotective or overbearing. She's just totally cool with it, which I feel like Aunt May would be. Because, I mean, there's plenty of versions of Aunt May where it's implied she knows, but she doesn't. She's not literally out talking to him about it. I did like that dynamic, and I think it freshened up the relationship, but I did kind of miss. I want, again, because Marissa Tomei, again, she's not in these a lot. She is so good.
Yes.
So anyway, we have all of that. They get to Europe. You've got all these action sequences. I didn't even realize the first time I saw it, the reveal of Mysterio's identity is just an hour into the movie. It feels like more than an hour has passed, but it's like 59 minutes into the movie, and then you've got a full second hour, so it's like very well paced. It's got that great three-act structure. I don't know. There's so many good things to talk about. Where do you want to go with it?
I mean, one thing I want to talk about, because I think it's a really interesting thing they did. So after I watched the movie, I went home and rewatched the first trailer for this movie, because there were like a couple of moments from that trailer that I remembered that were cut from the film. And if you watch that trailer, there are a lot of scenes that take place that would take place during like a different first act of this movie, which is a whole first act where Spidey is in New York and he's doing his Spider-Man thing and he like stops like a bank robbery and tells the cops that he's going on a vacation, like all that stuff.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, he goes to the one guy from the convenience store from Homecoming and talks to him about it. Like, oh, there's a bunch of these little like brief moments in the trailer that are used to set up the idea of Spider-Man going on this vacation. And it feels like that was, there must be like a version of this, a cut of this movie that exists that's like 2.5 hours long, that you have this whole like 15 to 20 minutes in the beginning of him preparing to go on this vacation that they turn into like a montage instead. And so that's not, like the first act is not him getting ready to go for the trip. Like the first act is him going, like him on the trip and encountering Mysterio and all that. And that's something that I could, that like really fascinated me, because I was kind of expecting there to be this bigger buildup to him actually going to Europe, but them cutting all that shit out and just being like, no, that's the start point of the movie, is Peter going on this trip. Like that has to be the beginning of the movie effectively. And the movie has to be about what, like dealing with that. It's not about him building up to it. And so that's one of those things that I think was probably a hard choice to make, that like really builds the whole movie, because I can imagine a much more tedious version of this film, but what they have now is this like very slim, slick version of this movie that's like way more direct, and has this like, as you say, this really perfect feeling of pace, because it doesn't have to belabor itself with all this setup that it seems like they probably filmed and just cut out.
Yeah, again, like one of the things I talk about a lot, because I teach it a lot and I work with it, is three-act structure. And this movie has very teachable three-act structure. Like, inciting incident is the thing that starts the story but is usually outside of the hero. That's Mysterio showing up in South America.
Yeah.
Then you get the point of attack, which is where it comes into the character's universe. That's in Italy when he meets Mysterio on the bridge when he has the fight outside of his costume, which is a fun action sequence with the Hydro guy.
Yeah.
And So, like, and if that happened, if the point of attack happened 45 minutes into the movie, wouldn't work. That would be way too long and laborious, and I would kind of be checked out. It happens exactly where it should, which is like 20, 25 minutes, and then the Mysterio reveal, which would be the second act twist, you would call that the midpoint of the movie, literally happens an hour into the movie. The midpoint doesn't always need to be the exact middle, but in a lot of good three-act movies, it is for a reason. And, like, that's a very teachable example of it. And, yeah, if they had 20 minutes in New York at the beginning, I don't know if it would work as well. I would like to watch those as deleted scenes on the DVD, but I think this cut is very good.
Yeah, and that's one of the things when you said earlier about Spider-Man Homecoming feel like a TV pilot. Like, I think that's some of the stuff that would kind of... If it had those things, it would feel like here's, like, two episodes of the Spider-Man Netflix show or something, like, tied together. Like, that's the kind of thing you could get away with on a TV show that a movie just can't do because you need to keep that pacing up. And so, yeah, like, that's one of the things I was most kind of fascinated by immediately was just how quickly they get into he's just on the trip. And it's, like, fucking great. Like, this movie just starts and it just goes immediately.
Yes. And even though that early part of New York is short, they set up a lot of really fun character dynamics, like Peter, not that he doesn't want to be Spider-Man anymore, this isn't Spider-Man 2, but just that he needs a break, which
yeah.
I get. I need a break. Of course Spider-Man needs a fucking break. He went to space and got zapped.
Yes, we all have, you know, we all need a vacation. The 15-year-old that fought, like, the space god and it was, yeah, dusted, he definitely needs a fucking vacation.
Yes, he wants a vacation. He is into Zendaya's character, MJ, who we will talk... She's so great in this, and I love that character. And he just, you know, he wants to try to get in with her, and Ned has his ideas, and so all of these are kind of established before we even get on the plane. We get on the plane. There's some very funny stuff on the plane with him and Martin Starr and everybody. And just, again, it moves through that very well. And while we're on that topic, those, like, teenage dynamics, that is something I want to touch on here, because I think this movie does it incredibly well, nailing that feeling of, like, having a crush on someone in high school and coming up with a plan and trying to figure that out and then, you know, kind of reading all the different signals and sometimes reading them wrong. It's really good at that. And Homecoming was pretty good at this, too, but I felt like there's an authenticity to all the teenage romance stuff in here that, like, really hit home. I really liked all of that.
Yeah, like, basically all of the school stuff, I thought, like, not just, like, the school stuff, but, like, stuff at the school. I mean, just, like, all, like, the class and the teachers, all that is really, really well put together. Like, you have the, because actually the thing that, you have that, like, little brief moment with Mysterio at the very beginning of the movie, but then you come in on the In Memoriam video playing
yes.
over the morning announcements, which is, as someone who just finished student teaching in high school, perfect. Like, they just, holy shit, is that, like, all the effects and the music and, like, the, like, weird overlay of, like, the doves flying over a picture of fucking Tony Stark. Like, all of that is just fucking pitch perfect. It's amazing.
The piece de resistance of that scene is it ends with a piece of clip art that has the Getty Images logo on it.
Yes.
It's still got the watermark, so they didn't pay for it. I really also like them reimagining Betty Brant as, like, the kind of, like, type A blonde girl mm-hmm. who becomes Ned's girlfriend. She's also just kind of steals the show in the background of this movie. She's
yeah,
great.
Because she was in the first movie, but she was only on the announcements, and so it's fun to, like, pluck her out of those and then, like, input her into the main cast and have her interact with everybody and have, like, Ned's weird summer girlfriend. So yeah, and then all that stuff. And then, but for me, just because I just need to talk about it now because it's just so on my mind, the amount of stress I repeatedly felt over the course of this movie from the perspective of the teachers was unfucking believable. Because the idea of taking a full class and ferrying them around another goddamn continent is the most horrifying idea. It's like this is not a teen comedy superhero movie. This is a fucking horror film for me, Jonathan, because, like, it's the thing where I feel like if I watched this movie when I was 14, I would look at the Martin Starr character and be like, haha, what a funny, goofy teacher character. Now I'm looking at, like, I'm with you, man. Like, as soon as, like, some kid makes up some weird fucking allergy, and I'm immediately like, I don't know what that is. I've never heard of that. I'm putting you in the other side of the fucking building. You are not, like, I'm not going to get sued because you have some fucking weird allergy kid. Like, I'm not, this is not my responsibility. Or the best moment is when he, after, like, they're all, you know, locked away and, like, traumatized from the attack of the monsters, he comes to their rooms and is like, well, I just want to say, you know, if you want to talk, I'm going to be here for you, and I want to talk with you guys. And they're like, no, we're good. And it's like, oh, thank God, because honestly, I'm not trained for that kind of counseling. It's like, that's the most, like, honest, genuine shit of, like, I'm a teacher. I've not been trained for, like, how to talk to kids in that way. Like, I'm not a counselor. I'm not a fucking psychiatrist. And yet, somehow, it becomes your job for most of your actual, like, day is to be that role. And so him, like, having to constantly deal with that and the stresses of making sure these children are not just murdered or get themselves killed constantly is the most genuine, authentic thing I've seen in a movie in a while.
And before there's even monsters involved, right?
Yes, because... no, yeah. It's the monsters are, like, whatever. They're a metaphor for, like, eating pencils or whatever the dumb shit kids do, you know?
And that's why Martin Starr is such good casting, because he can be funny and goofy and make you laugh, and I also 100% believe him as that man who has that life and, like, goes home and, like, takes the teacher coat off, but he is this guy, and, like, because Martin Starr is just a very genuine dude, and it's, yeah, it's so funny. And also that J.B. Smoove, who's also just a very funny guy, keeps, like, kind of, like, putting his duties off on him, and it's great. Martin Starr, I'm going to say so many of these, but another favorite moment I have of him is when he's giving the, Peter comes and sits next to him on the plane, and he's talking about his ex-wife who pretended to blip away, and he's like, yeah, we had a funeral for her and everything. Turns out she ran off with our gardener or something, and it's just like, you feel that this guy has, like, lived this life over the last 5 years, and he's still teaching these fucking kids.
And he has, like... He doesn't have other adults to talk to, so that's why he's telling this kid this story. Another, like, great teacher moment that feels very real is it's near the end of the movie. I forget what the exact line is, but something of, like, where the Martin Starr character turns to the J.B. Smoove character. It's like, no, we're getting off this bus, Julian! And he just uses his first name. And it's like, that feels very real. That feels very true of, like, that, like, this moment is broken down and we're not doing Mr. Whatever. It's like, no, Julian, we're moving now.
Yes. No, all of that is so good. And just all the kids, they really do. This is the thing that Homecoming 100% nailed. This movie nails maybe even more, is they feel like kids.
Yeah.
Like technically most of these actors are 21, 22, but they feel like 16, 17-year-old kids. Zendaya's MJ and Tom Holland's Peter totally feel like people I knew. In moments, they feel like people I was. It's funny because, like, you also just, you start relating to different people. Like, I feel Ned in this movie, because also the Betty Brant character, that's the kind of girl I was into in high school. I wish I could say I was more into, like, the weird MJ character, because that's the kind of person I would be into now in terms of, like, weird artsy types, because I hang around with a lot of MFAs. But, like, in high school, like, nope, I was into, like, that kind of type A person. And so I totally get where Ned is coming from. And I think they're very funny. And the girl who plays the Betty Brant character is so good at that. She just is that character. It's so good. And, yeah, you also, when you're talking about, like, the stresses you feel, if you can get past the, like, we are teachers now and we relate to the teachers, you also totally feel, like, the sense of anxiety Peter has about, like, MJ hanging out with Brad, who is a great comic foil in the movie.
Yeah.
This kid who glowed up over the time of the blip, and, like, it hits that anxiety so well. It feels really genuine and authentic, and it's not even necessarily the main point of the movie, but it puts Peter in a position that, again, he generally has not been on in film to this degree, where they just nail the high school superhero thing.
Yeah, and it definitely is, like, everything with, like, watching him with his stupid fucking plan and all that stuff, he's like, dude, God, Jesus, stop, what do you do, like, this doesn't make any sense, this is such a weird, convoluted way to try to go about this, but it feels so authentic to the, like, no, we're going on the fucking field trip, I've got this whole plan figured out, it's like, no, don't do the plan, nobody does the plan, that's not how it works.
But it's so good. Yeah, so all of that is great. Let's stay with the kids for a second, because I just want to talk about some of these characters. I think we talked about most of them, but I do want to focus in for a minute on Zendaya as MJ, because she was mostly background in Homecoming. She's there, she makes her, like, kind of dark quips, and she's, like, sarcastic and everything. But here she's a real character, like, front and center. She's really great. She's very funny. I also really love that in the second half of the movie, like, once she and Peter are, like, out to each other and they start, you know, being friendlier, the, like, mask drops, and she's really good at playing MJ, like, of course this is all an act. This is her being, like, dark and sarcastic and all that. It's a put-on. And when she finds out Peter is actually Spider-Man, she's like, what? I didn't... That was just... I was, like, 60% sure. She's really funny.
Yes, no, and that's one of the big things, is they're so good at... Because with Peter, we've known... Because since we're, like, Peter's kind of our main character, he's our sort of POV, we kind of know that when he's putting things on and when he's not, because we're with him all the time. And he's on all, like, constantly putting on, like, a weird kind of macho persona that's not really authentic. He does that in Homecoming, he does that here. But with the MJ character, because we're so removed from her... You can, if that person was a real person in real life, you would know that that's a put on. But it's not always clear when that is, like, a character in a movie, how cognizant the writers and everyone are of, like, that that's really kind of who that person is. And seeing that mask slowly kind of slip away, and then kind of getting the, like, seeing the chinks in the armor, and how it's like, you know, that's not totally inauthentic. She does like that stuff. Like, that's a part of who she is, but she's not, like... But she's also a teenager. Like, she has the same kinds of insecurities. She has the same kinds of desires as any of these other kids. She just expresses them and enacts them in very different ways. Seeing that, like, scene of them together on the bridge when they're, like, weird and awkward together because they're both attracted to each other, but neither of them want to say anything. So Zendaya does the Spider-Man thing instead because she doesn't want to, like, it be real, and she doesn't think that Peter really likes her because Peter also doesn't think that she really likes him, and they're, like, both weird about the whole thing. Like, all of that dynamic feels so true to life of the awkwardness and the inability to communicate anything in those moments. That comes across so much in the performance with both of those actors.
It's also just very refreshing to have a live-action Spider-Man movie where the romance is not played at the operatic, this is my ride-or-die-for-life level. Mm-hmm. Like, MJ in the Raimi movies, who I really like, I love that dynamic, but that is the love of his life, and, like, this is my one for the rest of my life. And in the Andrew Garfield, it's the exact... Because Gwen Stacy is just MJ in those movies, but she's blonde. They didn't actually write Gwen Stacy. And then in this one, like, I don't expect that Peter and MJ will be married and have three kids together, and that will be their life. It's not that they're bad for each other or anything, but they're kids. Like, this is a first crush. This is a, like, summer romance. Like, and it plays that very well, where the stakes are just inherently different, and they feel very human and down to earth. And I like that a lot. And they continue it on through to the very end when they have their first kiss on the London Bridge. And then at the end where she goes flying with him. And of course she hates it, because any human who is not Spider-Man would hate that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you need to have all the weird, like, spider balance. Like, I feel like anybody else who would go swing like that would just vomit immediately, because they don't have, like, the super sense of balance and agility that Spider-Man has. So it's like their frame of, like, reference is just shifting around like crazy. Yeah, so them going with the more realistic version of that scene, I like.
Yes, no, it's very funny. It's all good. So, yeah, I'm sure thinking the other kid I wanted to mention, because he's in the other one, but Flash Thompson in this, Tony Revolori is so fucking funny. He has such good comic timing, and, like, he plays a douchebag so well. And there's two moments I want to point out. There's one, it's in the trailer, but it's even better in the movie, where he's talking about, like, Spider-Man, like, of course he's a hero. He inspires me. He inspires me to be a better man. And then without missing a beat, looks at Peter and is like, what's up, dickwad? And the moment that's not in the trailer is he, like, does this, like, little wink. And it's like, so perfect. And I love that about Flash. And then the bookend of that, I feel like, so when they get back home at the end and his limo driver is there, he's like, could mom not make it?
Could mother not make it, is what he said.
Yes. And it's like, you feel so bad for Flash Thompson. I don't know how this kid in this universe got the nickname Flash. It's very... I want the backstory on that. But it is very funny, his whole role in the movie. And I love him there in the background.
And, like, his whole thing of, like, he's got his hashtag Flash Mob that he's constantly, like, Instagramming to. Like, again, like, that feels so authentic of, like, all these fucking kids that have like have their weird like small social media following that's probably like destroying them, and it makes me sad because I'm like, oh god, what are you doing? You don't know the world you're like stepping into. This is frightening for me, but it's like, but that's a thing that like lots of teenagers do today. Like they have YouTube accounts, they have, and they like live stream themselves and stuff like that. Like they are very active, or not all of them, but like some of them are very active in that way on social media. And it is that kind of thing, and they definitely, it's heightened a little bit for the movie, especially because he's a kind of a background character, so it has to be heightened a little bit, but it does feel like it, like that is real, like that is stuff that kids really do. For people who have not spent time with teenagers these days, that is not them just like making shit up.
And again, in the terms of this being a very tight script and a tight edit and like being structurally smart, having that be the payoff of how Peter and Happy find the kids in London is brilliant, because it takes this little joke, and that means that little joke gets to have a dual purpose, and you're not wasting time on like some convoluted way they find that the kids are in London. You just have, oh, we get both a big laugh out of this, and we get to skip a bunch of exposition later in the movie. That's good screenwriting.
Yeah, I also really looking forward to the home video release, where I can pause anytime they have his account up on the phone, so I can just look, because he has to have like some dumb like comments and like a, like I hope he has like 11 followers or something. Like he needs to have like a like sadly small amount of people engaging with his stuff. Like I really want to see all that shit.
Absolutely. Which you will need to buy the DVD, because this and Homecoming will be the only MCU movies not on Disney Plus, because they are technically Sony movies.
Yeah, it's always a like shock when, at the beginning of the movie, the fucking Sony logo shows up, and like, oh, right, yeah, the rights to this are so weird.
Yes, but hey, it's clearly a deal that has worked out for all parties involved well.
I'm happy about it.
Yep, everyone, like, because Sony basically just gets someone else makes the movie for them, they get all the money, Marvel gets to use Spider-Man all over the place and pump up their box office for Endgame and stuff, and Kevin Feige's happy because he gets to finally make a fucking Marvel Spider-Man movie, and we're happy because we get to see it, so good deal. But
yeah,
yes.
And the movie industry is happy that Disney gets to do this without just sinking Sony Pictures.
Yes, exactly. That's maybe the best thing about it, is it's like not an anti-competitive move.
Yeah.
All right, Mysterio and that whole side of the movie. Let's talk about, Sean, how utterly, thoroughly they nailed Mysterio, who might have to go down in history as the goofiest comic book villain to be this thoroughly nailed in a movie, right?
Yeah, it is something where, you know, they made all the right updates with his character, because I have not read a modern Spider-Man Mysterio story. I think Mysterio's dead. I think Mysterio's been dead for a while, or like Quentin Beck, the original Mysterio. And I don't think the Ultimate Universe never really did much with his character. So for me, Mysterio is very much the 1960s Quentin Beck. He's like a stunt actor and like special effects wizard kind of guy who uses all of his knowledge of like practical special effects and stunt work to pull heists and impersonate Spider-Man and do all the shit he does. He impersonates a psychiatrist and fucks a Spider-Man's head, all that kind of stuff. And so taking that character and updating it for, one, putting it into the MCU and having him be one of the people that Tony fucked over, I think is good, just sort of like flavor for the world and kind of resonance with some of the Tony themes in the movie. But then also having it be these like drones that make these like really advanced sort of projections, and actually having it tied into that one weird scene from like the beginning of Captain America Civil War. Like that's a smart hook in. All that stuff does a really good job of taking the core basic thing you need for Mysterio, which is he's this guy who creates illusions to trick people. And usually what he does is use the illusions to create a problem that he then convinces people that he's the only one that can solve it. And that's like the quintessential Mysterio story. They have found such a smart way of updating that and hooking that into the MCU while still keeping it be, it is still that Mysterio story. So if you go back to our podcast from like 2 months ago, whenever the second Spider-Man Far From Home trailer is, I like laid out basically the entirety of the Mysterio plot of this movie, because it follows the beats of who Mysterio is perfectly. And that's one of those things where that's not a bad thing, that I go into the movie knowing what the villain's going to do. That means that they know what makes this villain work and what makes his stories interesting, because good Mysterio stories are great Spider-Man stories, and they just stuck to the playbook with that character, and they fucking nailed it.
Absolutely. And like, that's that's what makes this a Marvel Spider-Man movie, I feel like, you know?
Yes.
Not that I mean, Spider-Man movies have, there are 8 of them now, and all of them except Amazing Spider-Man 2 have good villains. Like, even Spider-Man 3, I feel like Sandman should be in a different movie. It's a good version of Sandman.
Oh, it's a great version of Sandman. Yeah, if they had had the actual Sandman movie, like, Thomas Hayden Church would have knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, so they've always nailed Spider-Man villains, and it's really nice to see them, like, get this deep into the roster and take Mysterio and do him right, because I don't know if I would have predicted you could have done Mysterio right in 2019, and they did, and they didn't change the core of the character, as you say, like, because I know enough about Mysterio that I knew that was going to be the plot, and they got it so perfect, because it's not just that, it's how the second half really uses the illusion stuff, and how thoroughly Peter's head gets fucked with, and all of that, like, they nail every beat of it. And Jake Gyllenhaal, utterly perfect casting, because Jake Gyllenhaal is in that little pantheon of actors who are, this is like, there's this type of male actor who is, like, really hot and good looking, but is also a fucking weirdo. And I feel like, and there are a lot of those these days, like, Chris Hemsworth turned out to be that guy, right?
Yes.
And we didn't know that in the first Thor, but he became a lot better when we learned he was a fucking weirdo. And I feel like James Marsden has been that at times. There's plenty of these. Jake Gyllenhaal is a fucking weirdo, and he's basically playing Mysterio like his character from Nightcrawler, and it works so... I can't imagine anyone else doing that, and doing it, like, just like the facial hair, and how he looks in the costume, and how he interacts with Peter. It's all perfect. I love him in this movie.
Yeah, and I love, like, how they choose to play the, like, how long they hold on him being, like, this weird hero that's solving the elemental thing. Like, just long enough that you're, like, even me, I'm almost convinced, like, are they, like, really just going to kind of play this more straight and then do some, like, are they going to do a really weird twist to, like, surprise people who are Spider-Man fans or something? And then that moment when he starts, you're like, oh shit, okay, the thing with the glasses, and you start slowly seeing the kind of the con working. And then that moment when Peter leaves the bar and he kind of has his hand up, and you see, like, people start turning around weird, and then things in the background start phasing away, and it's just that, like, just slow pan around him, and he's like, all right, we got it, guys, and everybody jumping up and celebrating. It's such a great, like, surreal, weird moment, and I think it's so smart for them, even for, you know, if you're a Spider-Man fan and you know Mysterio's thing is illusions, holding into the, like, this is, the illusion is real version of reality, of, like, this is what is going on, holding on that for so long is absolutely what they needed to do, and there's a... You can very easily imagine another version of this movie where, like, the scene at the very beginning gives a hint that Mysterio is not what he seems to be, and, like, give the audience more insight into that. And I think having us have the same POV for Peter for so long in regards to the Mysterio stuff is such a good choice, because then when it breaks, it feels like such a dramatically powerful moment. Like, that's this movie's version of Peter showing up on prom night and opening the door and fucking Michael Keaton standing there. And it doesn't have quite, like, the gut punch that that does, but it is such a perfect moment for this movie when, like, all the kind of scales fall from your eyes and Mysterio is revealed to you.
Yeah, I mean, as much as most of the Spider-Man movies have good villains, the MCU Spider-Verse is, like, they're 2 for 2 on Michael Keaton as Vulture and Jake Gyllenhaal as Mysterio. And there's a certain joy in it being two villains that I don't think non-MCU productions would have done.
Yeah, you know, it's not Dr. Octopus, it's not Green Goblin, like, it's not even, like, the Lizard even is more mainstream, it's certainly not Venom or Carnage or, like, any of those characters. It's, you know, these respectable, you know, like workaday fucking Spider-Man villains. We've got Vulture and Mysterio. They're not the big sexy villains that you do, like, here's, like, our 3-year comic arc around this, you know, the Lizard. It's like, no, it's just every once in a while the Lizard pops up and or the Vulture shows up and he wants to, like, you know, rob a bank and Spider-Man stops him. Or Mysterio shows up and he's got some wacky harebrained scheme and you got to deal with it. It's like, cool. Like, they're a good, just, like, normal level Spider-Man villain that, you're right, like, normally would not get a whole movie about them.
Exactly. But it's so good. And I also, this is slightly unrelated, but I just have to say, because of our history on this podcast, I am so happy we have made it through 2 MCU Spider-Man movies and 5 Tom Holland appearances with not even a hint of Green Goblin or Oscorp or any of that. Just It's not in this universe. And that's fine, because it has been done to death.
Yeah.
It's not there. They're not even doing Easter eggs. Just like, thank God. If you want to do that story eventually, maybe. But there are so, like, I would so much rather have the Mysterio movie than our third Green Goblin movie, right?
Yeah, and you're right. It's not even just that the Green Goblin's not there. It's also that they're just not doing the Osborn stuff, which is nice because every Spider-Man reboot thing just does so much with Osborn. And, like, Ultimate Spider-Man did so much with Osborn, and, like, that's how Spider-Man becomes Spider-Man, is the formula from the Osborn stuff. That's basically what Spectacular Spider-Man does. The new the Insomniac game has a lot of Osborn stuff in it, although, it's, you know, they mercifully don't have him actually just beat Green Goblin in that game yet. And then, obviously, The Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2, like, there's a lot wrong with those movies. But, like, one of the main things is they're so preoccupied, particularly, too, on building this weird Spider-Man, like, movie cinematic universe thing with the Oscorp stuff that just crumpled immediately. And it's just nice to have this very normal, pleasant, like, yeah, it's just, like, Mysterio's just Mysterio. He doesn't have to be this whole weird Osborn, Norman Osborn conspiracy. If they want to eventually have Norman Osborn in it, I'm sure they'll do it well. But yes, having Spider-Man be out from the shadow of all that stuff, because there's a lot of Spider-Man stuff that just has jack shit to do with Norman Osborn. He doesn't have to be in everything. It's really nice.
Yeah, I don't want them to ever do it in this universe, because, like, this is the other thing that I think, if we want to bring in some of the MCU connections, that's what having the MCU does for Spider-Man that is such a gift, is that that background, like, mythology and universe that the Osborn stuff usually play, that's usually the role Osborn plays in all these adaptations. That's already there through Tony Stark and through the Avengers and all of that, and we all as an audience know it because there's 20 other MCU movies, and these movies don't have to waste shoe leather on setting that up. If they want to invoke the name Tony Stark, we just know it, that a relationship exists. Peter is in the Avengers movies. It's fine, and then Tony gets to kind of play that role, and it feels so much more natural and, like, a part of this world than if, like, Ned said, hey, what about that Harry Osborn kid sitting in the back of the plane? Like, that would fucking suck. So, like, this works so much better, and then it allows them to get straight to the meat of, you have Mysterio and you have Vulture, and they're both related to Tony Stark in some ways, but again, they're not having to, like, go around the edges. We know Tony Stark. He was a big presence in these movies. That's fine. That's, like, good organic storytelling with all of your different pieces. That's using every part of the buffalo, right?
Yeah.
So, like, this works. And I think it's a big gift to these movies that they can do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think Homecoming leaned on it a little too much. But this one, it's got really just as much of it. I just think it's a little more organic with, like, one, it is fun to have Nick Fury and Maria Hill there because, like, and we've actually gotten a lot of Nick Fury this year because he was also in Captain Marvel.
Yep.
But I think having him with someone who is emphatically on a lower rung than him, right?
Yes.
Peter Parker and Happy Hogan, they are not Tony Stark. They're not standing up to Nick Fury. So that is just a very fun dynamic. They don't overwhelm the movie. They're exactly where they need to be in the movie. And so you've got all of that. You do have, I think, again, the existence of Tony Stark means you can buy the leap of all of Mysterio's illusion tech and stuff. It's like, oh, of course, we've seen Tony do crazier shit than that. Of course that exists. There's just a lot of little things you have there. And I also think and this is where we can also talk about Mysterio and the different kind of father figures in this movie, having Tony Stark be almost the Uncle Ben figure in this movie, who is the dead father figure who is kind of hanging over Peter in this movie, I think works thematically really well. It's a good palate cleanser from Endgame, but I also think it's a good way to further Peter's character arc, because one of the questions of these movies, both metatextually and in the universe, is what's Spider-Man's going to be in this world with all these superheroes that is now a little lesser in terms of superheroes because a bunch of them died.
Yeah, it's that who's going to be the next Iron Man, and, like, how do you move on from, like, how do you move out from under the shadow of Tony Stark, which is both what Spidey's trying to do, but it's also what Mysterio's trying to do, right? Because he was, you know, and that little flashback to that scene from Civil War where they put Jake Gyllenhaal in there is really good, and it's that sense of, like, right, we're, like, you know, where the world will continue to pay for some of Tony's mistakes, because that's part of who that character was, is he you know, he constantly was kind of his own worst enemy and created his own problems in many ways. And, like, seeing that now that he's not here to clean up for that, like, other people are going to have to start cleaning up after his mistakes because he can't do it anymore. Like, that... There's something about that that feels so natural and how it fits into all the things we know about these characters in this world. And it is that thing of where... I agree. I think it's not that Far From Home has less of the connective tissue to the MCU, but it's less intrusive. Like Homecoming has... Like, it's really fun to have a lot of Tony Stark in that movie because it's fun to see Spidey and Tony Stark interacting with each other. But inevitably, Robert Downey Jr., like, overpowers every scene he's in that movie. And it's ultimately maybe, like, a detriment to that movie because it makes it feel like it's such a big thing there. Whereas here, it's omnipresent, but it is always in the background. It's never something that the movie is, like, shoving directly into your face. And whenever it is kind of shoving into your face, it's in a brief moment that is usually, like, really artfully done. Like, I love that moment when Mysterio puts on the glasses for the first time when they're in the bar and you see, like... You basically see him through the eyes of Peter and how much he does, like, evoke that image of Tony Stark for you. And that moment is, like, so touching and feels really authentic, even when, at this point, the audience certainly is supposed to have caught on that there's something wrong with this dude and, like, this is a weird situation that he's kind of egging on. It's still really touching and emotional, and it starts building those kind of father-figure themes together.
Because it's also worth saying, I also think this is a story where Peter Parker is in the driver's seat a little more of, mm-hmm. like, his own arc and his own wants and desires, and, like, it's his story. And that's true of Homecoming, but Homecoming, I also think, is too built its plot on kind of, A, a lot of contrivances, and B, a lot of Peter being restless and doing stupid shit and then having to clean up for the stupid shit he did when really, like, just a clean phone call to Happy Hogan would have, like, solved most of that movie. He tries at the end, but it's too late. So, like, but this one, like, Peter makes mistakes, obviously. He shouldn't give the glasses to Quentin Beck, but he doesn't know he's Mysterio. He doesn't know he's in a world where Mysterio exists, and that's an obvious, like, plot turn. So I feel like his mistakes feel more genuine, his triumphs feel more genuine. And it's a compelling character arc. Like, there's the scene on the plane near the end of the movie, which I have a story to tell about this. Give me a second. I'll come back to it. But scene on the plane at the end where Happy Hogan is there, and he and Peter talk about Tony and about moving on, and then Happy turns on at the back the little lab, and Peter starts working with it, and Happy sees Tony Stark in him. Jon Favreau is so good in this movie.
Yeah.
And he's only got a couple scenes. I am so glad Jon Favreau is still in these movies. I'm so glad that, like, he didn't get pissed off at Marvel after Iron Man 2 was not a happy experience for anybody, and that he still does it, because Happy Hogan is one of my favorite characters in the MCU, and it's because Jon Favreau is so good. And that moment is just, it's really, really lovely how human the ultimate stakes are here.
Yeah, and it's that, like, the little moment where he sort of, like, scoops up, like, the digital, like, version of his glove, and Happy puts on AC/DC and all that. Yeah, it is. It's a good evoking of all the Tony Stark Iron Man stuff without it overpowering the identity of Peter Parker. That is, like, he has those things in him, but he's not Tony's clone. You know, he's still his own person.
Because the best moment there is Happy saying, "I loved Tony Stark. He was my best friend, but he made so many mistakes, and he." You know, he second-guessed everything. And just letting Peter know, like, he was human. You're human. It's okay to be human. It's okay to fuck up. We're here for each other. We'll figure it out. I love that moment because there's also, like, if you didn't have that, you would... And I was wondering this both time I watched it. Like, in my head, I'm doing the headcanon of, like, Tony Stark would become the basis of a religion in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who, like, he literally died for humanity. Right?
Yes.
And, like, I like that there's just that moment where you cut through and, like, no. Tony did a really great thing at the end of his life. He did some bad things, too. It's okay to talk about those. And, like, humanizing it. Just a very good moment.
Because, again, like, all this shit with Mysterio would not happen if Tony didn't fuck all that shit up.
If he wasn't an asshole to everyone.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out when you're an asshole to everyone, and also most of the people you meet are also, like, geniuses and, you know, like that create this incredible technology, eventually someone's going to get pissed off and try to destroy the world.
Okay, I have a funny story to tell about the scene in the field, though, where the plane comes in and it's that really colorful field, and they're in the Netherlands.
Yes.
And Happy touches down there. So the other night, so I went to see this movie Thursday night, which was July 4th. And when I got out, I have been, just to make some extra money on the side, I've been doing some driving with Lyft, the rideshare company.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like July 4th evening, so I was getting some rides because people were coming home from bars and stuff. And I drove this one couple home, and they had just gotten out of Spider-Man earlier in the day, and I had just gotten out of it at night. And they said, they were talking about it, and then they said, oh, hey, have you seen Spider-Man? To me. And I was like, I just got out of Spider-Man. And they're like, oh, my God. And we started talking about it. And the girl, she had a little accent, and she was from the Netherlands. And she showed me, she had that field was her phone wallpaper for years from home. She knows that place. She has it just as her, like, iPhone wallpaper. And she said when it showed up in the movie, she, like, that was, like, her J.K. Simmons moment. Because she just knows that area. And I was like, that is such a weird coincidence. I finished the movie, picked up this couple. They had just seen the movie, and she had, like, been to that place. That was such a weird moment.
That is very bizarre.
Yeah.
That's where you start to question whether or not we're all living in the Mysterio illusion.
You know, they tipped me, so I'm fine with that. But anyway, so yeah. Where else should we go with this? Like, definitely talk about Mysterio in the second half of this movie when he makes the turn. One, I love Jake Gyllenhaal playing the... Because, like, Mysterio is not, like, a mustache-twirling villain. He's just kind of a petty asshole.
Yes, yeah, he's... I mean, he has that quality where he feels like an Iron Man villain of that he's just, like, a Tony Stark that's just a little bit further over the edge. And so he has, like, all those qualities of he's very smart, but he's very, like... He's extremely egotistical. He thinks that everything he does is the right thing. He doesn't really care about other people. He has no really real empathy for them. And he plays that really well. If he just comes across as this petty fucking jackass that just wants all this glory for himself, and somehow he's managed to convince all these other people to work with him too, even though clearly he doesn't give a shit about them. And like seeing that turn of how well he plays like that sort of like the doting father figure to Peter, and then as soon as that mask is off, it's like immediately he's the biggest asshole in the room.
And he's so good at that. And the other thread I want to pick up on here that I think is brilliant in this movie is it's kind of a meta narrative about superhero movies at a certain point. And there's the scene in the like fake diner that he's made, not diner, but German bar.
Yeah.
And he does the whole thing where he's given the toast to all the people, and it's our big exposition dump, but it's very fun. And at the end he says, and then, you know, and he's making fun of like the dumb costume and everything, and at his like big last like villain lines where you know he's a little unhinged, is he's like, and then the world, they won't be listening to these idiots in costumes, they won't be listening to this 16-year-old kid, they'll listen to me. And all I could think is, he is every angry newspaper critic who's ever had to review a superhero movie. Right? Because he's like, fucking kids in costumes. I hate this shit. This isn't what I signed up for when I did this job. How can other people enjoy movies? God damn it. And like, that's who he is. And I feel like it's too pointed not to be intentional. And it like continues like with him like, I love the scene where he's like practicing the illusion in his workshop. And he's like, no. Rewind it. Go back. Double the damage. Let's try that. It's all of that like meta element is really fun, I think.
Yeah, it definitely has like the, you know, yeah, being able to see behind the illusions and then kind of playing it back. And it is this like weird like future fucking VFX workshop thing he's in with the drones. Yeah, it definitely gives you that sense of the... It reminds me of The Girl Who Died, the Doctor Who episode. Of where they use the footage to trick the Vikings. Like, it has that sense of, like, them being able to kind of contextualize movie spectral effects within the universe of the story, and that is always a very fun little kind of trick to pull.
Because I will say, when you see the movie a second time, which is totally worth it because there's a bunch of things that kind of get recontextualized at the end of the movie, watching those first two big fights with the Hydro Man and the Fire Man are really funny when you know that's all special effects that Mysterio has planned. There's just things about it that like are there's an extra layer of like comedy and irony to it when you know exactly how he worked all this stuff out, you know? Yeah. But anyway, so you have his plan in the second half of the movie is all the stuff in London. And actually, we should rewind here and just talk about how good the action in this movie is, because again, there's those first two big fights, and no two fights in this movie are the same, down to Peter is in a different costume in every major set piece of this movie.
Yeah, and this movie has that thing that most of my favorite Marvel movies have, which is they allow themselves to be extremely creative with like the tools that are available to them, which is definitely like something that Homecoming did not have. Like Homecoming's action stuff is very, very basic. Here, they look at, okay, what do we have? We have Mysterio, we have, you know, this elemental illusion, we've got Spider-Man, we have these characters we can put in harm's way. How can we kind of put all these, like, pieces together to craft?
And Europe. You have all these, like, locations in Europe.
Yes, yeah, and all the iconic landmarks in everything with Europe. How do we put all these things together to create a unique action sequence? And they always come up with really creative things for all the characters to do. And you're right, like, it never looks the same. All of them aesthetically are very different, down to Spider-Man's costume, but they also just never sort of just settle for very basic, normal action scenes that you've seen. You know, if you've seen these movies, you've seen 100 fucking superhero action sequences. None of the action sequences in this movie feel like they are like those. They are so uniquely Spider-Man and so uniquely affixed to his powers and the powers of Mysterio and all these drones. That they never just sort of like take those things for granted and really push them and be creative with them.
Because you've got four big set pieces, I would say, in this movie. You've got the one in Venice with the water guy, and that's where you have Peter out of his costume, and he's just in his normal street clothes, and a little bit in a weird Venetian mask.
Yeah, and he's just sort of like desperately trying to sort of keep the city from falling apart while Mysterio is fighting the illusion.
And I loved that scene, like, Spider-Man scene in Venice, awesome. That's like a superhero bucket list thing. Let's get that off. I love that. Then you've got the big scene in Prague with the fire guy. And in that one, he is in the stealth, what they call in the video game, the stealth suit. But the black suit with like the hood and everything. And that, I love that suit.
I think you mean the Night Monkey suit.
Yes, exactly. Night Monkey. Oh, the Night Monkey is such a good joke.
I loved how long they kept the joke going. Of like, you just would constantly hear in the background, oh, Night Monkey! Run!
That's when he's like on the train to Berlin. Someone like he tries to ask for directions. And they're like, ah, Night Monkey. It's so good. But yes, you have that scene with the fire guy. That's great. You have my favorite set piece in the movie. My favorite thing in the movie is the big illusion scene in the third act, which is, again, it's a Batman Rocksteady scene. Or Rocksteady Batman scene, like the Scarecrow scenes,
yes.
Where it's just, you can't tell anything is real. It's constantly changing. It's really visually creative. I have to tell you, Sean, the moment, and in that scene we should say he is in the Homecoming suit, the original, like in the illusion, he's in the original Homecoming suit. And I am absolutely 100%, when this comes out on DVD, I am ripping the DVD, I am taking that scene, and I am syncing it with a James Bond theme song, because the visuals in that scene are a James Bond theme song opening, where you have like the 100 Mysterios coming in, and there's that one shot where like zooms slowly into Mysterio's helmet. That is where the director credit for a James Bond movie would come up.
I had not thought of it that way, but you're 100% correct. Yeah, there is like, they do such a good job of, like, again, because it's that thing where Mysterio, I think it's very easy to make Mysterio very, very lame. But when you commit to it so hard, they really kind of convince you that his ability to create illusions, it just feels kind of unstoppable once you reach that point, because you're so disoriented. It's not just that what you are seeing is fake. It's that all the fake stuff you're seeing is shifting so rapidly from different tones and palettes. And your like reference point for everything is just crazy. And it's constantly moving around. And it is like Spider-Man has just been trapped inside of, you know, the wackiest fucking James Bond title sequence you could make. And it really does convince you that like, it makes you say, how could anybody fight against this? Like, it seems so overwhelmingly powerful what Mysterio is able to coordinate together, down to, you know, it does like the sort of Inception, like dream within a dream thing of Spider-Man thinks he's woken up, tells the stuff to Nick Fury, obviously fucks up, and then Mysterio backs him out into the train. Like, that whole way it's all choreographed. Again, when I said earlier that this is like the best you could ever hope for in terms of Mysterio on film, like that's really, like all the character stuff is great. That's really what I mean, where like, it's hard for me to picture someone being able to handle a Mysterio illusion sequence better than what this movie does.
Because it's so creative, it's so cinematic, it's genuinely scary at times, but it's also just visually stunning. Like, it is, I think, one of the most interesting cinematic moments in any Marvel movie, is all of that illusion stuff. It's just, like, very dynamic filmmaking. And then the entire action sequence in London, what's so great about that action set piece is that it ultimately has one very small goal, which is I have to get in that fucking hallway and punch this dude. And once I've done that, it's over. Like, he just has to get in that hallway and hit that guy. But there's so much, like, there's all the drones and all the illusions, and there's so much in between them. And you're right, that's like, Mysterio is just a dude. They even say this on the plane with Happy, is like, he's just a man. If I can get near him, he's done. But he has all these tools, and those illusions are, like, genuinely very disorienting. So in that last scene, you also, then the last suit you have in the movie is his new Spider-Man suit, where you replace the blue with black. So, Sean, I just want to back up for a second. We like talking Spidey suits in this movie. What did you think of the new costumes?
I like it. I mean, yeah, I kept on meaning to load up Insomniac Spider-Man and play with the new costumes, but every time I started to go to, like, boot it up my PS4, I saw the Judgment was right there. I'm like, I need to play some more Judgment. So I have not played them with them in the games. But yeah, I really, particularly, you know, I think the stealth suit is very cool looking, but it's sort of very plain. I think his new, like, Spider-Man suit that he creates for himself is very cool. It's very distinctive. You know, it doesn't quite look like any other Spider-Man suit, though it still has the Spider-Man quality to it. It pulls very direct inspiration from the original Steve Ditko drawings, where in the original Spider-Man design, like, it honestly wasn't really red and blue. It was like that, like, comic book black that has blue outlines on it, like Superman's hair or something like that, where you know that Superman's hair is supposed to be black, but they use blue to kind of outline and kind of define it and give it a little bit more definition. And that's what Spider-Man's original costume sort of looked like. And so they kind of go with that and then have him have the underarm webbing things, which is one of the fun, weird, most inconsistent pieces of Spider-Man costume design, that he is supposed to have that underarm webbing for, like, basically 30 years of comic books, but every other artist just sort of, like, decides to draw it only every other panel or something, because it's just must be a big pain in the ass to draw. So they've taken that underarm webbing stuff, they've taken that black design, and they've all put it together. And one of my favorite things about it is that they keep the sort of MCU thing of him being so inspired by Iron Man and having, like, more kind of Iron Man tech inside of his suit, which I'm fine with. I know that some people don't like that stuff because they feel like it makes Spider-Man too powerful or something. And I feel like it's a good thing for MCU Spider-Man to have that to kind of help define him. But I'm glad that they didn't make the suit, like, all kind of metallic looking and everything like the Iron Spider suit. I'm glad that he only has that Iron Spider suit kind of at the beginning of the movie, because I think that's fine for Avengers. I would not want him having that in Spider-Man. I think this has a very authentic Spider-Man feel to it, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, I think the new suit, that should be, like, the default for MCU Spider-Man going forward. It's a really good suit. I like that he created it himself with the help of Tony's technology, obviously, but he did the design. It's really good. The stealth suit, I really like in the movie. It's way better in the game. One thing about it in the game is, like, whoever did it in the game went crazy with the texture on it. Like, play it and watch a cutscene with it, because, like, the texture on, like, the, like, wool over his head and everything is just, it looks real. It doesn't look like video game graphics. It's crazy, like, well-designed, and I like playing around with it. And I also just, I have a fondness in the Insomniac games for anything that has a lot of black in it, so I also do like the new suit. I have one big complaint about this movie, though.
Okay.
And it is that when he has the stealth suit on, whenever he talks to someone, he flips the eyepiece up. I don't get it. I don't know why he does it, because one of the best things they do with MCU Spider-Man is they CGI the eyes. And they have the eyes, like, dilate and move around and everything. And it gives Spider-Man so much more personality than he's ever had in a live-action movie. And it allows, like, Tom Holland's performance to shine through more, because you have those eyes to look at and everything. But when he flips it up, the whole stealth suit just looks dumb, and you kind of lose the, like, thing that ties it together, and you just see these beady little eyes in there. You don't need to do that. I don't know why they do. They do them, like, five different scenes, and I don't know why. It kind of annoys me. It's the same way Peter taking his mask off throughout all of Spider-Man 3 does. It's not that bad, but it's just, it's like, it kind of ruins the illusion of the suit, and I don't know why they do it.
I have a counterpoint. I really like that because that's not his. He did not make that suit. That's not a Spider-Man suit. That's this weird German lady just sort of put this together. And so, like, I, in my head, that German lady, like, when she has to make the eyepiece, is just rolling her eyes like, how fucking dumb it is that you have, like, the way. And so him, because it feels like, it, I think one of the things it does is it makes it feel like he is uncomfortable in that suit. So he has to,
okay,
you know, wearing that is like wearing a Halloween mask or something. So he has to flip those eye things up because it's probably just, like, suffocating him. I like that. Like, I like how it makes it feel like he's a kind of a fish out of water, which is what he's in the, like, he's not a fucking SHIELD agent. He shouldn't be wearing this, like, weird black jumpsuit with, like, all these straps and shit on it with these weird, like, visor goggles. He's Spider-Man. So that's why I like it. It definitely looks lame, but I think it's supposed to look lame.
That is totally fair. And I want to underline, this is the nitpickiest fucking thing I will ever complain about on this podcast. It does not matter. But I also, I understand your argument, and I might come around to your way of thinking. All right. But we do get that big last action sequence in London, which is really fantastic. Like, just the sense of him, like, swinging all around the London Bridge, and the scope of that sequence is so good. I love all the cutaways to Happy and the kids, which is both funny, but also a good, like, ticking clock drama element that they throw in there.
Happy gets that great line when they're all in the vault and they're all, like, sharing their stuff. He says, I'm in love with Spider-Man's aunt. And everyone just, like, looks at him. And I love, like, how different the reactions are for the two people who know who Spider-Man is and the two people who don't. It's like, yes, they're all confused, but they have very different confused looks. I think that moment is played really well.
I like MJ just picking up a fucking mace and beating a drone with it. That's pretty cool.
Yep, that's badass.
I also, one thing I fucking love about this scene, it took 8 movies, 5 of them with web shooters, we finally have a Spider-Man action sequence where Peter runs out of web fluid and has to work his way around it. I don't think that's ever happened in a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I haven't seen Amazing Spider-Man 2 since it was in theaters, so
it doesn't in that, at the end of Amazing Spider-Man 1, Lizard crushes his web shooters, right, but it's like the very end of the fight. But this is, he does the whole thing where he can't get up there, there's the drones, so he gets the big sign that he uses as a shield, and then rigs a bomb out of that drone, and he throws it at the drones, and then uses the impact to, like, bounce him up. That's really cool, and that feels like something you would get in a TV show or the comics where they do the running out of web fluid thing a lot more.
Yes, no, that is absolutely, like, it is a very comic book feeling moment of, like, honestly, like, the reason why the web is finite in the web shooters is just because it is, like, a useful plot device of, ah, shit, like, I would totally stop the Vulture right now, but damn, gosh darn, I sure did run out of that web fluid, so I gotta go back home and come, you know, and, like, they got away because I ran out of web fluid, and, like, having to come up with more creative solutions to those problems. Yeah, like, I like it a lot because I also like that it feels like earned that he runs out of web in that moment because he's using it so much. And it's one of the things I really love about the first part of that sequence where he's swinging around the bridge and making these, like, big, huge webs to catch all the drones. Is it, like, it makes him truly feel like Spider-Man, like he's catching these flies in his web. Like, I think that's like a really cool aesthetic. And then, yes, once he finally runs out of web, it's like, that's just like a great hero shot where he gets the fucking sign on his arm and has that, he's just like the drone, like, hanging, and he just, like, stands up, is like, okay, fucking let's do this. It's a very, like, I think maybe it's supposed to kind of, like, mimic the image of, like, Captain America with the hammer from Endgame.
Yeah, that's what,
like,
I thought. Yeah,
it's got that kind of, just like, okay, I'm going to fucking throw down kind of look to it, but it's a very kind of cobbled together version of that.
Yes, because I've always thought in Spider-Man movies, I think Sam Raimi had the right idea. Just make it part of his body. He shoots the web because in a movie, you're not really going to do anything with the web fluid. So it actually it removes this whole layer of exposition and like plot stuff to just have it be natural. And I feel like, okay, finally, they earned having web shooters, because if you're going to have web shooters, you have to, like, I think in the other movies, you could still just assume they come out of his wrist because there's no difference between the two of them. I really liked that moment. Speaking of shields like Captain America, there's also the very good moment where Jon Favreau throws the shield at the drones and is like, how does Cap do that? it's kind of a dumb joke, but it made me laugh because Jon Favreau failing at throwing that shield is very funny.
Yes, because I was very much expecting him to throw the shield and it to hit the drone right before he closed the vault. And it just, like, because it's not even just that, like, it sort of falls short. It's not even close. And I think that's what makes the joke very funny to me, is, like, just how terrible a fucking throw it is.
It's so good. All right. And then you've got the final standoff with Mysterio, which is really good and freaky. And Mysterio feels, you know, fully unhinged at this point. He's basically shot himself a la Green Goblin at the end of Spider-Man 1, the first Spider-Man 1, now that we have three yes. Spider-Man 1s and three Spider-Man 2s we have to distinguish between. We have four Spider-Man 1s, because there's Into the Spider-Verse. Anyway.
And now we have the video game that's just called Spider-Man, and maybe the sequel to that will just be called Spider-Man 2. So we're definitely in Spider-Man title hell at some point.
We are. I like at least this trilogy is distinguishable by the home-based titles.
Yes.
So anyway, but you have that final scene with Jake Gyllenhaal, and he gets shot, and there's one final illusion. Really good standoff. One other thing I do think this movie does well is that the emotions between Quentin Beck and Peter Parker are real, even if Beck is tricking him. Like, Beck really does like Peter, and Peter really was getting something from this guy. So it makes that last standoff feel more earned and like a big character moment, like where, like in a lot of Spider-Man movies, it has to end with Peter feeling kind of horrible because he had a human connection with this villain. That to me is one of the things that distinguishes Spider-Man villains, is having that human connection with them, which a lot of comic book villains don't have. And I think they do that really well in that last scene, even as you learn in the post-credits scene, Beck had a bigger plan going on there.
Yeah, or I'm not sure if that bigger plan is Beck's or if it's the other guy who takes the flash drive, kind of manning the drone. I think that's... But anyways, so with Mysterio's last stand, one, you just have that great payoff to his spider sense, or his Peter Tingle, as they call it.
Oh, it's so good, yeah.
Which, because it was one of those things where they just never really brought it up before, whether or not he has spider sense. So I like the way that they kind of seed it in this movie, and they have him use that to defeat the drones. And I just like the image, going back to the thing of like the lenses and having the animated lenses. I love that they just straight up have the lenses just close, like he's closing his eyes, even though it makes no sense. Like, I don't know how that helps you. You just close your eyes inside the mask. But that's what they would do in a Spider-Man comic, is they would just animate. They would draw the eyes as if the lenses were shut closed to communicate that, like, yeah, he's focusing on just sort of feeling it with his spider sense. And it's just a great, just... It's like Neo at the end of The Matrix, like, nothing can stop him. I like that it's not, like, once Spider-Man gets to that point, it's not a challenge for him anymore. And he just immediately overcomes it. I'm really glad that they don't try to do, like, Spider-Man almost falls for the last thing that, the last sort of card that Mysterio has to play, his last little illusion. Spider-Man's not buying it at all. He absolutely knows what's really going on, and I like that they play it that way, that he has, at this point, he has completed his character arc, so he is seeing through all of Quentin Beck's bullshit. And it is something that's very emotional for Peter, because he does have those legitimate feelings of affection remaining for the guy, but I like the it's a very Spider-Man level of like determination, despite like the emotional turmoil he's going through, and all that is communicated through so well through Tom Holland's acting.
Yeah, we haven't talked a lot about Holland in this, but we've talked about him so many times on this show, mm-hmm. because he's played the part 5 times, but he is so good. I think this is maybe his best work as Peter yet, because it's just the biggest performance in terms of scope and everything. And yeah, he's really great in that final moment, because he has that final line to Quentin, like, you know, your tricks don't work on me anymore. And then I think Beck's final line, and this is why I wasn't sure how you were supposed to read, like, the trick that's played, is that whole really ominous thing he has while he's dying about, like, people will believe anything anymore. Which, like, if that resonates today, Mysterio would do very well in our current political atmosphere.
Yeah.
And, then it sets up the cliffhanger very well. But yes, very good stuff there, and that's the end. And then we have them going back to New York, and Ned and Betty break up because it was just a summer fling, and adults move on, and that whole thing is so cute. And Peter and MJ go swinging around together, and that's it. That's the movie, right?
Well, yes. No, yes. But the one thing I want to point out about that sequence, and this is one thing that I think is smart about them having very little of Spider-Man in New York at the beginning, is that is the first time we've seen this version of Spider-Man swinging around Manhattan.
That's true.
He's only ever been like Queens and stuff like that before, and this sequence of him swinging around Manhattan in those like huge skyscrapers, that's the first time this version of Spider-Man has done that, and there's something like weirdly like cathartic about that to me. Of oh, he is like, you know, he's, since they have gone with this very very young version of Spider-Man for these movies, it feels appropriate that we have built up to this moment where now he feels like he's legitimately Spider-Man. He's
yeah,
in Spider-Man's haunts. He's doing the Spider-Man shit. He's flying around with MJ under his arm, swinging all over the place. It's a very cool moment.
I totally agree. I love that this Spider-Man went to space and fought Thanos and got snapped before we saw that. That's all just A+. Love that that happened in that order. But Lynn, yeah, no, it's a very good, it is like a cathartic, like, we're back home. Because, like, the whole thing is they're away from home the whole movie. There's no way to make it seem more like Spider-Man is home than have him swing through Manhattan, right?
Yeah.
And I'll say this. If I had any complaint as the credits started to roll about this movie, it was that in the back of my head, I was a little bit like, Peter, things worked out really well for Peter in this movie. Like, maybe too well for Peter Parker. Like, he got the girl, he got the trip. He won. He got home. Like, you know, he had to go through some shit. He did get hit by a train, and that's pretty fucking hard.
He very almost died. Like, they really... Yes. He got fucked up in this movie.
He got fucked up. But, like, you know, he's got his aunt. He's got Happy. He's got, you know, it's pretty good for Peter Parker. Things turned out surprisingly well for him in this movie. Post-credits scene. And they Peter Parker him good.
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly. You, whenever anything goes well for Peter Parker... Anything the universe giveth to Peter Parker, they taketh away twofold. And so now the public thinks that he murdered Mysterio and, like, a bunch of other people using the drones. And then J.K. Simmons' J. Jonah Jameson reveals that Spider-Man is, in fact, the degenerate Peter Parker.
Yes. And why this has to be in part Mysterio's plan, because while he's in the... In the clip, there's something that we don't see on the bridge where Mysterio is saying his real name is Peter Parker.
Well, that could easily be faked. I think that's part of the point.
That's true. Okay.
That's part of the point is, like, it's impossible to know what is true or not. And
right.
So, like, because it would only, like, the only way that would be part of Mysterio's plan, I think, is if somehow he is still alive, which I don't believe. Because
I think it could happen, but probably not.
Yeah, because because that character to me would never. There's no reason. He has nothing to benefit by. He's not okay. Driven by spite towards Peter Parker. So that's why my read is because they have this weird lingering shot on the guy at the laptop running the drones. He like pulls a flash drive out and like grabs the laptop and leaves. And I think you would only linger on that if that's supposed to be your sort of like hint at. This is how this is all put together, is he now has sort of assumed either Mysterio mantle or he's going to do something. And he needs to kind of turn the public against Spider-Man to do whatever he needs to do.
Yeah. But let's talk about this as like, where do we go from here? Because the MCU does not do cliffhangers a bunch. The only ones I can think of are Thor: The Dark World has the stinger with Loki is now taking the place of Odin, which... They kind of hand wave away in Ragnarok in very, very funny fashion with the whole Matt Damon play and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously Infinity War, big cliffhanger. Everyone just got zapped. But this is like Peter Parker can't go back to being normal Spider-Man anymore. Like, he's fucked. He can't go to high school anymore, you would assume. Like, yeah. He is completely fucked. What the hell do they do from here? Like it's not just he was unmasked. It's the terms of the unmasking. It's pretty big because, you know, it's not like we, you know, the comics and different media have never done a Peter Parker unmasked story. It's a lot rarer than for a lot of other superheroes.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm really curious how they do this because this also, they can't just put that genie back in the bottle. Their MCU Spider-Man will now no longer have a secret identity, which even further distinguishes this character from every other media incarnation of Spider-Man.
Yeah, and it's something where I'm, like... For, like, the Amazing Spider-Man movies, I was fairly resistant to how, like, sort of cavalier they were with the Spider-Man secret identity. With Homecoming and, like, these movies, I'm much more fine with it because I think they do a very good job of, like, planting the flag that this is not... this is not Spider-Man as we know him. Like, this is a fairly different take on the character, in part because of how, like, youthful he is for how long he is youthful, which is not... While we associate that with Spider-Man, that's not actually typically Spider-Man's thing. Like, Spider-Man was only in high school for, like, a couple of dozen issues of the comic book. He moved to college very quickly. And so the way that they have sort of played this character, I think they do a good job of evoking a lot of, like, core Spider-Man stuff while also very much making it its own thing, which I think is unique to when you've had two other Spider-Man, like, cinematic versions of Spider-Man within the past 20 years. So yeah, like, it makes, if anything, it just makes me very excited to see what that, like, what the consequences of that are. And not just for Spider-Man 3 or, you know, Home is Where the Heart Is or whatever the fuck they call it. Where do we go going forward now for the rest of the MCU movies? Because other than the fact that we know that eventually they're going to make a Guardians 3, and we know that they are currently making that Black Widow movie, although we don't technically even know really what that Black Widow movie is, we don't know what the next slate of movies is. We don't know what their plan is going forward with the MCU, other than there's going to be more of these. And this is a really cool way to set that off of... It makes me really excited to see what happens in the next Spider-Man movie, but it also kind of makes you sit there and think about where are they going to go for the next sort of phase of these movies now that Iron Man, Captain America, and those kind of stalwarts are not going to be around.
Yeah, because technically there is no date for Spider-Man 3. There's no... We don't know anything about it. It has not technically been greenlit. If you look at the, like, initial contract they signed, Tom Holland has one movie left. He was... The whole deal with them was that the MCU Spider-Man would be in 3 Marvel movies and 3 Sony movies. So they've done the 3 Marvel movies, Civil War and then Avengers 3 and 4. And then they've done 2 of the Sony movies, and then they'll have one more. I assume everyone will re-up at a certain point because they'll want to do more, and it's been lucrative for everybody. But, like, it's definitely a big question mark. They obviously would not have included the cliffhanger if there were any doubt about going forward, I feel like, because it would be easy to yank from the movie if there was, like, last-minute contract issues. So hopefully, like, because this came 2 years after Spider-Man 1, so hopefully 3 will be 2 years again, so that'll be 2021, and that's the fastest they could presumably make it. And Disney has 3 Marvel movies on the calendar for 2021, so that would wind up being a 4 MCU movie year, which has never happened. So we'll see how that all shakes out. It sounds like Marvel is going to announce their next slate at Comic-Con, or around Comic-Con. Sounds like it's the plan, is when we'll learn more. Because we literally, this is the last, we don't know what the next Marvel movie is. We know none of them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of exciting. And I assume they'll probably announce the Spider-Man thing with all of that, because they and Sony are pretty tight on this. But it definitely fascinates me. I'm very excited to see where it goes. And you're right. It's like, the next movie, I have no idea what it will all be about. And, like, what villain could step in to, like, be the thing that challenges him in this way. What is Peter Parker's daily life become because of all this? You know, there's no Tony out there to, like, take care of him through all of this. There's no Cap. We don't really know what, like, the Avengers leadership is anymore, like, what the Avengers are. So there's a lot of big, big questions, and it's very exciting. And we haven't even talked about the second post-credits scene, which also does some weird, funny stuff with the movie.
Yeah, really quickly, I want to say my theory, I'm going to place my bet for the villain of the next Spider-Man movie. I think they're finally going to do Kraven the Hunter. Because Spidey's been exposed, Spider-Man is on the run, and Kraven is hired by J. Jonah Jameson or somebody to hunt him down. That is my bet of what, like, the A-plot of that movie is basically going to be, and that is a very exciting idea to me.
That is the best idea I've ever fucking heard. They absolutely have to do that. What home-based pun do we do with that one?
I mean, I do really like the idea of Spider-Man Home is Where the Heart Is, because it's such a, like, welcome mat fucking thing to do. You know, home away from home, you could do that.
Spider-Man Home Alone.
Exactly. No, yeah, there you go. Spider-Man Home Alone, Spider-Man hooks up into, like, a fortress or whatever and, like, sets booby traps for Kraven the Hunter. Like, that would be a ridiculous movie and a ridiculous title, but it would be kind of amazing.
I totally want the Kraven the Hunter movie. That sounds... Because Kraven is totally in that zone with Mysterio and Vulture of, like, there should be a movie about him, but no one else would have done it until now.
Yes, Kraven the Hunter is one of my personal favorite Spider-Man villains. I think he's great. He just, like... he puts Spider-Man on the defensive in a way that's very different from most other Spider-Man villains, and I think they have a very good setup to use that. So, obviously, we have no idea what they're actually going to do, but if I were in their shoes, that is what I would use.
Yeah, the big thing I'm curious about is how they deal with any potential time jump, because, like, this movie is set about, with all the things that... Okay, it's set 5 years after Homecoming, but in Peter Parker's, like, living daily life, it's like a year of his life later. I feel like a full year time jump would be weird, because where would Peter have been for that year in that he's outed? So we'll see. But that's very exciting. Do you want to talk about that last post-credits scene really quick?
Sure, yeah. So Nick Fury ain't Nick Fury, huh?
No. And when you watch the movie a second time, there are hints, because he's a little off. And Sam Jackson, I think, has fun with that. But I just loved seeing Ben Mendelsohn as that Skrull guy again, because he's so funny and good in that role. And just, I loved him, like, taking the mask off and just being like, oh, man, this guy's hard to play. And again, kind of in that meta way of, like, people playing roles in superhero movies. And then Nick Fury is doing something with the Skrulls off in space. I thought it was fun.
Yes, and that's one of those things of where it's like, I'm very glad that Sam Jackson is still on board for all this stuff, because because he's such a good character and actor to, like, play the role that he plays of sort of like just building up the blocks. He doesn't, you know, I don't necessarily need the Nick Fury movie. I just need those little moments of where Nick Fury's doing some weird shady shit somewhere, and creating, you know, whatever, like, the next step for S.H.I.E.L.D. is and all, like, it's a good, like, enticing thing of, like, yes, Nick Fury's up to some shit in space, something's going down, you know, we know that almost certainly they're going to make a Captain Marvel 2, you know, they're going to make a Guardians 3, so having more cool space stuff with Marvel, that would be nice, and having S.H.I.E.L.D. be able to be involved with that, I think would be cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Sam Jackson was almost gone from these movies for a while. Because he was in Avengers 2 for that one scene on Hawkeye's farm. And then he's out for most of Phase 3. He doesn't come back, I think, until Captain Marvel and then Infinity War 2. So, like, we had not seen him in a while. And he's been in all three movies this year. So, clearly, they re-upped with Sam Jackson. And I think the break from Nick Fury was smart, because it kind of let the movies breathe in different ways. And I also don't know where you would have fit him into Ragnarok or Civil War or any of those. Like you could have, but I think, like, they had kind of moved past it at that point. But he's got kind of an exciting new role in these movies. And yeah, Sam Jackson, just, he's kind of eternal. And I like that he just is still willing to come do, because it can't be that much work to play Nick Fury at this point. He's not, like, in every scene or anything, but he is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I really love those moments we get between, I mean, obviously we now know that it's not true Nick Fury, but, like, the Spider-Man Nick Fury interactions are very good, and
yes,
like, it again, of, like, the version, like, this version of Nick Fury, like, the Black Samuel L. Jackson Nick Fury, comes from the Ultimate Comics, where he was originally introduced through Ultimate Spider-Man. So for me, this version of Nick Fury and Spider-Man are, like, in my head, kind of tied together, and so it's nice to see some of that realized on screen.
Absolutely. Anything else to say about Spider-Man Far From Home before we call it a day?
I'm really excited. We find out more about what the next movie is soon. I cross my fingers, fucking Kraven the Hunter, let's do it. Jonathan, what if they just got Hugh Jackman to play Kraven the Hunter? What if they just said, fuck it?
That'd be so good. Oh my god, that would be amazing if they did that.
Because they already broke the rules and got J.K. Simmons back as J. Jonah Jameson. Like, it's a way less break of a rule to have the guy who played Wolverine play Kraven the Hunter. Like, you can just,
I mean, that's it. Not... They broke that rule with fucking Captain America. Chris Evans was the Human Torch in Fantastic Four.
So just, you know, because I really... It's hard for me to think of anybody.
Michael B. Jordan was also the Human Torch in Fantastic Four. They've done it twice.
Yes. Eventually, they'll cast their actual Human Torch for the MCU and then recast him as another hero at some point in the future, because that's just what they do. But yeah, yes. It's hard for me to think of an actor that would play Kraven better than Hugh Jackman.
And he gets to be Australian in it, right?
Exactly, yes. Like, that's what because I think that's the Ultimate Universe version of Kraven is Australian. So there's precedent for him being Australian, just have him use his native accent. It would be great. Yes.
I hope someone from Marvel is listening to our dumb little podcast and is just making the calls right now.
I mean, hey, if I've thought of it, fucking Kevin Feige has thought about it, so...
That's true, that's true. That's the one nice thing about the MCU is because of Kevin Feige and, like, the nerdiness of this universe, the weird thoughts you have about these movies, Sean, are not really that far out there.
Yeah, because nobody else would have played the Mysterio movies so straight as they do it here. Like, that's what makes it so good. They're just like, no, it's just a fucking Mysterio movie. This is great.
I'm so happy. We are in the golden age for Spider-Man on screen between this and Spider-Verse and the video game. Like, and they're all so different. Like, pick your flavor of Spider-Man. It's there for you, and it's all fucking great.
And then you have rock reflections of a superhero just sitting in the corner waiting to be played. You know, obviously that, you know, has been around for a while now, but it was only recently unearthed by me, so.
And added to Apple Music and Spotify and everything.
You know, nobody else knew about it until I found it.
Exactly, exactly. And we used it, I think, 8 or 9 times on the podcast so far. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. We'll find something fun to talk about. Listen to Weekly Suit Gundam. Play some Spider-Man. Play some Judgment. We'll see you next time.
I need to get back and play some more Judgment right now.